We leave Iberum with instructions to find us if his brother isn't freed with the rest, before hurrying along the corridors of Ridge House, trying to navigate our way to the Samos throne room. Tiberius is less helpful than he should be, his mind clearly elsewhere, with his brother in Piedmont, I suspect. I do my best to keep up with his long strides and Farley's, but I keep bumping into his back as he slows, lost in thought. We're already late, I grumble, putting a hand to the small of his back on instinct, shoving him forward. He jumps at the contact, as if burned by my touch. His larger hand covers mine when he recovers, pulling my fingers away. Then he drops them quickly as he halts, turning to face me. Farley keeps on, outpacing us with an exasperated groan. Fight when we have the time, she calls, urging us to keep up. He ignores her, glaring down at me. You were going to speak to him without me. Do I need your permission to talk to Maven? He's my brother, Mare. You know what he still means to me. He whispers, almost begging. I try not to soften in the face of his pain. It almost works. You have to forget who you thought he was. It kindles something in him, a deeper anger, a desperation.
Don't tell me how to feel. Don't tell me to turn my back on him.
Then he straightens, pulling back so I have to crane my neck to meet his gaze.
Besides confronting him alone, just the two of you? He looks over his shoulder at Farley. It isn't wise.
Which is why I sent for you. Farley snaps harshly. We need to go. That took long enough, and the council started 20 minutes ago. If Samos and your grandmother are scheming, I want to be there.
And what about Iris?
Tiberius says, recovering. He braces his hands on his hips, broadening his frame, to cut off any escape if I try to slip around him. He knows my tricks too well.
What was all that about dogs biting?
I hesitate. Weighing my options. I could always lie. It might be better to lie. Something Iris said before, when I was still at Whitefire, I admit. She knew I was a pet to Maven, a lapdog, and she told me all dogs bite. It was her way of communicating that she knew I would turn on him if I could. The words catch, but I force them out. Why, I can't say. So will she. Instead of thanking me, Tiberius seems to darken.
And you think Maven wouldn't catch that?
I can only shrug. I think right now he doesn't care. He needs her alliance. There's only today and tomorrow in his eyes.
I can understand that. He mutters under his breath, so only I can hear.
I'm sure you do. He heaves another sigh, running a hand through his short hair. I wish he would let it grow into dark waves again. He'd look more handsome, less rigid, less like a king.
Do we tell them what just happened?
He asks, pointing a thumb back toward the room. I frown. I would rather not retell our conversation to a larger audience, especially one that includes the Samos brood. If we do, we risk Rash and Iberum. Volo would enjoy using that particular advantage if he could.
I agree, but it is an advantage to be able to speak to him, watch him.
He lowers his voice, gauging my reaction, letting me make the decision. Leave him in peace. We can relay with the Scarlet Guard on the ground, get our people back. He nods along.
Of course.
No word about Cameron, I add, wincing as I say her name. She went back to Piedmont to be with her brother when we went on to Montfort, chasing peace instead of war, and war found her again. Tiberius turns thoughtful, sympathetic even, not for show, but truly. I try not to look at his handsome features as he looms above me.
She'll be okay, he says, just for me. Can't imagine anyone taking her down.
Iberum didn't mention seeing her among the prisoners, but he didn't think she was among the dead, either. I can only hope she's among the ones who escaped, hiding in the swamps, slowly making her way back to us. Besides, Cameron can kill a man as easily as I can. More easily. Any silver hunter would find her to be dangerous prey.
with her ability to smother the strongest of their powers. She must have escaped. I will entertain no other possibility. I simply can't. Especially because I need her for what I have planned. Farley might pop a blood vessel if we keep her waiting any longer.
I would prefer not to see that.
Tiberius grumbles after me.
15. Evangeline. Annabelle stalls with such talent as we wait for her chronologically impaired grandson. I'm torn between asking for a lesson and skewering her to the wall with the steel of my throne. There are maybe a dozen people in the throne room, only those necessary for a war council. Red and silver, Scarlet Guard and agents of Montfort alongside noble houses of the Rift and Rebel Norda. No matter how many times I see it, I can hardly get used to the sight. Neither can my parents. Today, Mother coils on her throne of emeralds like one of her snakes. She sinks back into black silk and rough gems, looking incomplete without some threatening predator pet at her knee. The panther must be indisposed today. She sneers while Annabelle spins her wheels. Father, on the other hand, sits in rapt attention, his acute focus locked entirely on Annabelle even as she steps back, trying to make her squirm. The head of House Laraland does not, to her credit. I'm a magnetron. I know steel when I see it. And she has steel in her bones. Tiberius the 7th needs a capital, a place to plant his flag. She pauses, pacing for effect as she surveys the throne room. I want to scream, "Get on with it, old woman!" What she should really do is go find Cal, wherever he might be, and drag him back here by the ears. The Piedmont base is lost, and this is a meeting of his own war council, not to mention my father's court. Making us wait isn't just rude, it's politically stupid, and a waste of my own precious time. He's probably off arguing with Mare again, pretending not to look at her lips while he does it. The prince is terribly predictable, and I hope the pair of them will boil over into some not-so-secret, secret relationship once more. Will I be expected to guard the door? I sneer to myself. In a flash, I envision the life he wants for us all, the life he would subject all of us to. The crown on my head, his heart in her hand, my children threatened every second by any child she might have. My days spent bending to his will, no matter how gentle it might be, no matter how many days he might let me spend with my Elaine, as long as he can spend his with Mare. If only he wanted her more. If only I could make him want her more. But as I told Mare back in Corvium, Cal isn't the abdicating kind. You weren't either, I remind myself, until you had a taste of the other side. At the thought, my insides flip, with excitement, with hope, and with exhaustion. I'm already annoyed by the prospect of tangling myself up with Cal and Mare more than I already am, even if it's for my own happiness. Stop complaining, Samos. When General Farley and Mare finally enter the room, with Cal on their heels, I sigh to myself. Mare Barrow is not unfortunate-looking. But she's no lady. Cal must like that sort of thing. A rougher edge. Warmth, dirt under fingernails, a rotten temper. I don't see the appeal. But he must. Ah, Annabelle says, turning gracefully on her heel. Your Majesty. Her face relaxes in relief as she beckons Cal to join her before the Samos thrones. The rest of the chamber looks on.
So kind of you to join us, King Tiberius, my father says.
He runs a hand through his silver beard, pulling at the strands.
I'm sure you've been made aware of our dire situation.
Cal sweeps into a low bow, surprising us. Kings and queens of the blood do not bow, not even to each other. Still, he does it.
My apologies, I was detained, he says, offering nothing else.
and giving us no opportunity to ask further as he waves Farley forward.
I believe General Farley has some good news, at least. Weighed against the loss of our foothold in Piedmont, Father scoffs, as well as any leverage we had over Prince Bracken, it must be very good news.
I consider over 100 of our people saved from Piedmont to be good news, sir, she says, also stooping into a quick, pitiful bow. The Scarlet Guard and our Montfortin allies left only a skeleton garrison behind in Piedmont. There were a few hundred soldiers left behind at the base when Bracken struck. Right now, according to our intelligence, at least a third have made it into the swamps. The Scarlet Guard has contingents all over the region. We are more than able to retrieve and transport those who escaped to safety.
How many dead do you estimate? Annabelle says, now standing to the side with her hands clasped.
100, we think, she forces out, as if she can run right past the thought. But it seems to catch up to her as she repeats more slowly.
100 dead.
We lost more in Corvium, I say, tapping my fingers in time. A hard trade, to be sure, I add, feigning sympathy before I send the red woman into a rage spiral.
It will be difficult going forward without the base,
Ptolemus offers, making the painfully obvious point. Sometimes I think he just wants to hear himself talk, even in situations like this.
Yes, that's true, Cal offers. We still have the rift and all that entails, but we've lost two of our conquests in so many weeks. First, Corvium.
We chose to destroy Corvium. We didn't lose it, Mayor puts in, eyeing him with venom. I'd wager she's glad to be rid of that city. Cal nods in begrudging agreement.
And now Piedmont, he continues. It doesn't exactly present the image of strength, especially to any houses aligned to Maven who might still be swayed.
Mother angles on her throne, her knuckles glinting with a ransom of green gems.
What of Montfort?
She raises an eyebrow, searching the room. I'm told you were successful in procuring their army.
I don't count my soldiers before they form up, Cal shoots back, harsher than he should be. I trust Premier Davidson will deliver what his government promises, but I won't make decisions based on resources we can't see yet.
What you need is a capital, Annabelle says, circling the conversation back to her original song and dance.
She paces, her red and orange regalia matching the light outside as it shifts toward sunset.
The city of Delphi will provide. The seat of House Larilan will support the rightful king.
Cal avoids her gaze.
That's true, but...
But...
She snaps to him, stopping in her tracks. He throws his shoulders wide, self-assured.
It's too easy.
Like a true grandmother, Annabelle pats him on the arm with the manner of someone teaching a toddler a syrupy life lesson.
Nothing in life is truly easy, but you take the breaks you manage to find, Tiberius.
I mean, it says nothing,
he answers, extricating himself from her grasp.
Not to the people of Norda, not to our allies, and certainly not to our enemies. It's an empty move, an expected move. Delphi is already mine in all but name, correct? I simply have to raise my flag and proclaim it.
Yes, she says with a blink. Why throw away such a gift?
He sighs, a little exasperated, and I share the feeling.
I'm not. The gift is already given. You're right. We do need another stronghold, preferably in Norta. Another victory to prove our strength. Put fear in the Lakelands and Piedmont, as there is already fear in Maven.
Where do you suggest? I ask, leaning forward, if only to move along his proposal and end this miserable show. He nods at me.
Harbor Bay.
That was your mother's favorite palace,
Annabelle mutters at his side, forgetting herself. Cal doesn't respond, as if he doesn't hear her.
And governed by families loyal to Maven.
It's strategic, he offers.
General Farley narrows her eyes. It's another siege, and another battle that could get hundreds of us killed.
It has Fort Patriot, Cal fires back. It services the Army, the Air Fleet, and the Navy Armada.
He ticks each one off on his fingers. His fervor is palpable, almost contagious. I can understand why he was made a general at such a young age. Maybe if I were a simple soldier, if I didn't know any better, I would willingly follow such a man into the jaws of death.
We can choke off a large piece of Maven's military, and perhaps win some of it in the process. At the very least, we'll be able to replace what we lost in Piedmont. Weapons, transports, jets. It's all there for the taking. In the city itself is a Scarlet Guard hotspot.
Father arches one sharp eyebrow. He is almost grinning, a ferocious sight.
A wise decision, he says.
King Volo's agreement seems to take Cal by surprise, but it shouldn't. I know my father and see the hunger in him, the lust for power that he always keeps close. I bet he already dreams of Harbor Bay laid bare, the Samos flag raised over the conquered city.
Maven has taken a fort from us. We'll take a city from him.
Cal dips his head.
Yes, exactly.
If you can take it, Mare replies, looking over her shoulder at him. Her brown and gray hair spins with her momentum, gleaming with a reddish hue in the sunset. He tilts his head, eyes narrowed.
What are you saying?
Attack Harbor Bay. Attempt to overthrow the city. It's a good risk and we should try, she says. But even if we fail, we can still strike a real blow to Maven's forces. In spite of myself, I find this intriguing. I smooth my skirts, rippled sheets of speckled silver and white silk, as I lean toward her. How, Barrow? She seems almost grateful, and shows me her teeth in what could be a reluctant smile. Split open Newtown, the techie slum outside Harbor Bay. Lose the Reds. It's a manufacturing hub, and it fuels Norta as much as any silver fort. If we hit Newtown, Greytown, Marytown... Again, Father is taken off guard.
You want to get rid of the tech centers?
He sputters, blinking at her like she told him to cut out his own beating heart. Mayor Barrow stands firm beneath his confounded gaze. Yes. Annabelle eyes Mayor in disbelief, almost laughing.
And what about after this war is done, Miss Barrow? Will you pay to rebuild them?
Mare almost bites off a chunk of her own tongue to keep back a sudden, unchecked retort. She takes a breath, willing herself to something within the realm of calm. If destroying them means victory, she says slowly, ignoring Annabelle's questions, winning the country? Cal's eyes shift and he steadily nods his head. Agreeing because she's right, or because he's still a lovesick puppy.
Breaking up even one tech center will greatly disrupt Maven's ability to fight back, and it will spread unrest through his supporters. If the Reds see us as liberators, that can only help us, he says. Add that to taking over Fort Patriot. He could lose control of everything north of the bay, all the way to the Lakelander border.
Thoughtful, he looks to his grandmother, opening his stance to her.
Cut off the entire region, and sandwich Maven between our already loyal Delphi, the Rift, and our new conquest.
I imagine Norda in my head, or Norda as she was a year ago. Lines carve across her lands, like a cook slicing up pieces of pie. One chunk to us, two more to Cal, and the rest. My eyes linger on the Red General and Mayor Barrow, and I think of that insufferable premier 1,000 miles away. Which piece will they take? I know what they want, at least. The whole damn pie.
Ptolemus makes a show of mulling over my proposition.
He runs a finger around the rim of his water glass, listening to the crystal sing. The sound is haunting, an ethereal echo weaving through our dinner. The sky behind him is blood red against his silhouette. My brother is strong-jawed,
broad, with my father's long nose and mother's tiny rosebud mouth. He looks more like her in this light, with the growing shadows gathering beneath his eyes, in the hollows of his cheeks and throat. His clothes are fresh and casual for him, clean white linen, light enough for the summer season. Elaine watches him play the glass with distaste, one side of her mouth curled into the beginnings of a sneer. The waning light gleams in her hair, giving her a ruby halo finer than any crown. She drains her own wine, staining her lips with berry, grape, and plum. I refrain for the moment, leaving my wine glass full and undisturbed. Usually, a quiet dinner away from my parents and the prying eyes of an assembled court is an excuse to drink as much as I like, but we have business to attend to.
It's a foolish plan, Evangeline. We don't have time to play matchmaker,
Ptolemus mutters, his fingers gliding to a halt on the crystal rim.
Harper Bay could be the end of us all.
I cluck my tongue. Don't be a coward. You know Father wouldn't risk you or me in an ill-fated siege. We are well cared for investments, Tolly. His legacy depends on our survival. Whether Cal wins Harbor Bay or not is of no interest to me. We do have time, at least, Elaine offers. She regards me with dark eyes that glimmer like starfall across a cornflower sky. There can be no movement without the Montfort armies, and we still have to outfit our own soldiers to build up for the siege. I slip my hand under the table, feeling the smooth softness of silk on her knee. This is true. And I'm not suggesting we ignore the war, Tolly. Just divide our attention. Look elsewhere when we can. Nudge pieces on the chessboard.
Nudge pieces into bed, you mean?
Ptolemus says with a dry grin. He moves his hand from his water to the stout glass of biting clear liquor and ice he's drinking.
You think I can influence Mayor Barrow without getting my throat slit?
He asks, tossing back a fiery gulp. He winces, hissing air through his teeth.
I think it's best I stay away from her.
I agree with that, I answer. Barrow promised to let my brother live. It's a promise I trust less and less every day. But you can keep an eye on Cal. I thought he was immovable, completely dedicated to winning Norda, but we may have an opportunity to stop that. My brother throws back another blistering swig.
We aren't exactly friends.
I shrug. But close enough to it. At least you were a year ago.
And what a year it has been,
he mutters, inspecting his reflection in the flat of his dinner knife. His face has not changed. His beauty is undiminished by war. But so many other things are different now. A new king, a new country, new crowns for us both. And a mountain of problems to go with each. The tumultuous year has been worth the cost, at least to me. A year ago, I was training harder than I ever had, preparing for the inevitable Queen's Trial. I could barely sleep for fear of losing, even when victory was all but guaranteed. My life then was decided, and I reveled in knowing what was to come. In hindsight, I feel stupid and manipulated, seeing myself as the doll I was, pushed toward a boy I could never love. And here I am again, trapped in the same place I've always been. But now I know better. I can fight it. And maybe I can make Cal see reason the way I did, see what our worlds are, the strings we all dance upon. Ptolemus picks around his specially made meal of lean, barely seasoned chicken, wilted vegetables, and pale fish meat. It lies mostly untouched. Usually he wolfs down his bland, healthy foods, as if eating them quickly can disguise the lack of taste. Elaine is quite the opposite. Her plate is clean, showing no evidence of the rack of wine-soaked lamb we shared. Indeed, she says. Her voice is quiet and measured. I tried to read her thoughts on her face, her carefully worn expression of thoughtfulness. Is she remembering our lives a year ago,
when we thought we would be happy beneath a Norton throne together, living in a future built on our secrets. As if we were ever truly a secret to anyone with eyes. What about me? Elaine prods, putting her hand over my own. Her skin is the perfect balance of warmth against mine. What part will I play in this? You don't have to do much of anything, I answer almost too quickly. She puts her hand over mine. Don't be stupid, Eve. Very well, I grit out. Do as you have before, I suppose. Shadows are perfect spies, well suited to the intrigues of a royal court. To listen, to watch, safe behind a shield of invisibility. I don't like the prospect of using her in any capacity that might be dangerous. But like she said, we have time. We're at Ridge House. She wouldn't be any safer if I locked her up in my rooms. Not exactly a bad idea. Elaine smirks a little and pushes away her plate, half in jest. Her nose wrinkles. Should I go now? I tighten my grip on her hand, smirking. You can finish off the wine at least. I'm not completely heartless. With a smile that stops my breath and leaves my pulse racing, she leans into me, her eyes drifting lazily to my lips. I know exactly how much heart you have. Across the table, Ptolemus finishes his drink, rattling the ice.
I'm right here, he grumbles, averting his eyes.
We have a week, at least, if not two, before Davidson and his army return. Enough time to do what I can, with the added advantage of my own territory. Cal and Mayor want each other, no matter how many obstacles might stand in the way. He requires only a very little push. If anything, a single word from Mare would send him scurrying to her bedroom. Mare, on the other hand, will be infinitely more difficult, married as she is to her pride, her cause, and that constant, unflagging rage she keeps burning in her chest. Of course, shoving the pair of them back together is only the first half of the endeavor. It's getting Cal to realize, as I have, the weight of a heart, and how much heavier it is than a crown. A small part of me wonders if this is impossible. Cal might never wake up the way I did. His choices could be set in stone. But that can't be true. I see the way he looks at her, and I won't give up so easily. I only wish I could solve all this with my own two fists and a knife. That might even be enjoyable. Quite honestly, anything would be more enjoyable than what I'm doing now, prowling through Ridge House at dusk, searching for Mayor Barrow. This is a chore and a bore. Elaine is gone, somewhere on the other side of the estate. Keeping an eye on General Farley while Ptolemus works through his evening routine in the training area. A routine that nicely aligns with Cal's own schedule. The would-be king is oh so married to his workouts, especially now that he can't burn off his energy with a certain lightning girl. I pass through the gallery halls, dragging my fingers across statues of reflective steel and polished chrome as I go. Each one responds to my touch, rippling like water disturbed on a still pond. Outside, the sky purples, and stars prick to life across the western horizon. The city of Petaris glows in the distance, several miles away, a reminder of the world still marching on. Reds and common silvers now living under the spreading shadow of war. I wonder what that must be like, to read about battles and hear of cities torn apart, and know you have no part in the conflict, no influence, no power should war come to knock on your own door. And it certainly will. This war has many sides, and there's no way to stop what has already begun. Norda will be a rotting carcass one day, with the Rift, the Lakelands, Montfort, Piedmont, and whoever else is left all howling over her corpse. I step onto the upper terraces, facing into the eastern darkness. A chill hovers on the air, and I think we might face a summer cold front before the week is out. Barrow isn't alone when I find her, to my chagrin.
She looks up at the stars while her red boy stretches out at her side, long limbs splayed without thought for appearance. He seems a tangle of blonde hair and bronze, sun-damaged skin. Killorn glances at me first, pointing his rounded chin in my direction.
We have an audience.
Hello, Evangeline, Mayor replies. Her knees are drawn up to her chest. She doesn't move, her face tipped to the sky and the growing starlight. To what do we owe this honor, Your Highness? She drawls. I chuckle and pause to lean against the railing edging the terrace tile, biting to the last. I find myself in need of distraction. Mare shakes her head amused. I thought that's what Elaine is for. She has a life of her own, I muse airily, forcing a shrug. I can't expect her to live at my beck and call. You spend all your time pretending not to pine for her, and now here you are in the same place again. But you're bothering me instead. Shrewd, she turns her gaze on me for a second, her brown eyes black against the deepening night sky. Then she looks back at the stars. What do you want to know? Nothing at all. I don't care where you and Cal scampered off to today, or why you both were so incredibly late to a meeting about the survival of your own people. At her side, the red boy tenses, his brows knitting together. Mare tries not to rise to the bait or the implication. She waves a hand, dismissive. It wasn't important. Well, if you ever need assistance with your unimportant doings, there are a few passages I can show you, ways to get around the ridge unseen. I tip my head, surveying her as she pretends not to listen to me. Cal sleeps in the east wing, near my rooms, in case you're interested. Her head snaps up. I am not. Of course, I reply. The red boy glowers, his eyes a dark green, the color of my mother's stormiest emeralds.
Is this what you call distraction? Taunting Mare?
Not at all. I was wondering if Mare felt like sparring a bit. She balks. I beg your pardon? For old time's sake. She huffs, as if annoyed. But I see the familiar twitch in her. The need. A coil in the pit of her stomach, begging to be unwound. Barrow looks at her feet, blinking slowly. She runs one hand over the other, smoothing her fingers against her palm. Imagining the lightning, no doubt. There is a particular pleasure in using our abilities for sport rather than survival. I've almost beaten you twice, Evangeline, Mare says. I grin. Third time's the charm. She glares up at me, annoyed at the hunger inside herself. Fine, she forces through gritted teeth. One match. Cal is also in the training arena. Not that Mare or Killorn knows it, though. The red boy follows us wordlessly, fuming, but he does nothing to stop Barrow when I lead her into the specially made chamber. The walls are glass, much like the rest of the ridge. In the morning, it enjoys a full view of the sunrise, perfect for early sessions. Now it looks out on the darkness, a vague, bruising blue fading to black. Ptolemus and Cal occupy different ends of the training floor, ignoring each other as men do. My brother steadily works through a rotation of push-ups, his back straight and lean. Ren perches nearby, seated in the raised viewing area. She must be the healer on duty to attend to anyone on the floor. But her attention is firmly fixed on Ptolemus and his flexing muscles. I could probably spear Cal through the middle, and she wouldn't blink an eye. The would-be king faces away from us at first, running a towel over his hair and his sweaty, flushed face. I watch Mare go stock still next to me, as if frozen solid. Her eyes widen, running over his figure. I can only grimace, noting the damp material clinging to Cal's back and shoulders. Maybe if I felt some attraction to him, or to any man for that matter, I might understand exactly why Mare looks like she's going to pass out. At least this part of the plan is working. Barrow clearly has no objections to Cal's body. "This way," I say to her, taking her by the arm. Cal spins at my voice, towel still in hand. He startles at the sight of us. Well, the sight of her.
"We're almost finished," he manages to sputter.
"Take your time. It doesn't make a difference to me," Mayor replies, her voice and expression decidedly neutral. She lets me lead her away without protest, but her hand shifts, her arm moving quickly. Her fingers dig into my flesh, nails biting and warning.
"Kalorn," I hear Cal say behind us, greeting the red boy with what sounds like a handshake.
Ptolemus looks up from his spot on the floor, not breaking his pace. I give him the slightest nod, pleased by our machinations. His eyes slide past me, though, to rest on Mare instead. She looks back at him, murderous. It chills my blood. I try not to shudder, try not to think of my brother bleeding like hers did, dying as he falls, dying for nothing at all. "Pull yourself together, Samos."
16. Mare. "I'm not an idiot, Evangeline," I growl as the changing room door slams behind us. She just sighs, shoving a training suit into my chest. With practiced, even motions, she strips out of her simple gown and tosses it to the side, discarding the puddle of silk like a pile of trash. Naked but for her underclothes, she pours herself into a training suit of her own, clearly custom-made for her, printed with a scaled design of black and silver. Mine is less ornate, a simple navy blue. Furious with her scheming, I pull off my own clothes before forcing the suit on. "You might as well just shove us into a closet and lock the door," I snarl, watching her braid her silver hair away from her face. She does it quickly, without thought, forming a crown around her head. Evangeline only twists her lips. "Trust me, I would if I thought that might work on you. Him? Yes, a closet would be enough. But you?" She throws her hands wide, shrugging. "You can never make anything easy." "So what? You're going to try to beat the shit out of me and hope he feels some pang of sympathy? Maybe have him nurse me back to health?" I shake my head, disgusted. "It seemed to be working in Montfort." Her eyes paw over me. "Those silences did a real number on you." My eyes narrow. "Well, I have my reasons." I snap back, defensive. The memory is like a slap to the face, followed by a deep kick to the gut. I dig my nails into my palm, trying not to slide back into the sensation of being suffocated. In the mountain foothills, in a palace bedroom, from silvers or from manacles. Without thinking, I circle my fingers around my wrist and squeeze. It almost makes me vomit onto the polished tile floor. "I know," she replies, softer than before. If she were anyone else, I might think that was concern shadowing her voice. But not Evangeline Samos. She doesn't have the ability to feel sympathy toward Reds. I cough, regaining some of my composure. "Even if you somehow did drive us back together, it wouldn't accomplish anything. You said yourself he's not the abdicating kind. It's a stupid plan, Evangeline," I add, "for both our sakes." She looks at me sidelong, buckling a brace of daggers into place around her thigh. One side of her mouth lifts. I can't decide if it's a smirk or a smile. "We'll see." All grace and agility, she crosses back to the door, gesturing for me to follow her out onto the waxed wood. I do so reluctantly, pulling my hair back into a neat tail. Half of me hopes Tiberius is already gone. I focus my eyes on a spot between her shoulder blades. "It's a stupid plan, not just because Tiberius already made his choice," I continue, sliding by her onto the training floor. Instinctively, I shift my weight to the balls of my feet, almost bouncing as we walk. I grin back at her. "But also because you're never going to lay a finger on me." She clutches a hand to her chest in false pain. The changing room door slams shut behind her. "Mare, I'm supposed to be the overly confident one." I keep grinning, walking backward to keep my eyes on her. I don't trust anyone to fight fair, especially her. Maybe Elaine can lick your wounds? Evangeline only raises her chin, looking down her nose at me. She does, and frequently. Jealous? My face flares red. I feel the heat of it all down my neck. No. Now it's her turn to grin. She shoulders past me, knocking her arm into mine with marked force. I twist, but she keeps her body squared to me, never letting me pass out of her eyeline. We start to resemble dance partners turning in a ballroom, or wolves circling in the dark. Predators testing each other, searching for openings and weaknesses, opportunities. I have to admit, the prospect of blowing off some steam and maybe getting a few good rounds in has me excited. Adrenaline already surges through my veins in anticipation. A good fight, the kind without consequences or any real danger, sounds especially delicious, even if it means admitting Evangeline was right about sparring. Across the floor, I spy Killorn looking on, with Tiberius standing beside him. Ptolemus keeps his distance. I don't waste my attention on them, even though Evangeline wants me to. She'll probably slice my face the second I drop my guard. "You should train more," she says, her voice a bit louder. It echoes through the open space. I wonder if Evangeline was simply born without shame. Work that stress out of your system in other ways, or with other people. I blink a rapid tempo, truly surprised. My entire body floods with warmth, and for once, it isn't Cal's fault. She grins at my discomfort, even tipping her head toward Cal and Killorn a few yards away. Both of them are clearly listening to our conversation, while simultaneously trying to look like they aren't. Evangeline raises an eyebrow toward Killorn, surveying him with a keen eye. The implication dawns on me. Oh, he's not— Don't make me laugh, she sneers, taking another step backward. I'm talking about that other new blood, the Montfort one, white hair, deep voice, thin and tall. Suddenly, the heat coursing through my body turns icy, and I feel the hair on my neck rise. Cal pushes off the far wall. His eyes slide past me as he turns, dropping into his final routine. Push-ups. He works at a steady but fast pace, rising and falling. In the silence, I can just hear his rhythmic puffs of breath over the embarrassing thud of my own heart. Why are my palms so sweaty? Evangeline leers, more than satisfied. She dips her chin a little, nodding, goading me on. Do it, she mouths to me. His name is Titan, and he isn't here, I growl, hating myself as the words come out. Across the room, Cal quickens his pace. This is an even stupider plan, I add, leaning in to whisper as low as I can. Evangeline tosses her head. Is it? She breaks my nose with her skull before I can answer. My vision spots. I see black, red, all colors in a dizzy spiral as I slump sideways, falling to my knees. Crimson blood spurts down my face, running into my mouth and over my chin. The familiar tang wakes something up. Instead of collapsing, I gather my legs under me and spring. My head collides with her chest bone, and I hear a whoosh as the air goes out of her lungs. She stumbles, arms pinwheeling as she lands flat on her back. I swipe a hand across my face. It comes back sticky with blood, and I wince, trying to think through the yowling pain. Across the floor, Cal is on his knee, eyes wide, jaw tight, about to get up. I shake my head at him and spit blood on the ground. Stay where you are, Kalor. He does. The first dagger sings past my ear, a warning. I drop beneath the second, rolling across the smooth, almost slippery wood floor. Evangeline's laughter rings in my ears. I silence it quickly, lunging forward to grab her by the neck. She twists before I can get a good grip and shock her into submission. Only a few sparks touch her as she slides away, using the polished floor beneath us to her advantage. Still, my sparks are not gentle. She twitches as she moves, as if trying to brush off a particularly tenacious insect. You're better than I remember, she pants, coming to a stop a few yards away. I clench one fist, the other pressed to my nose in an attempt to stem the river of blood. Not a pretty picture by any standard. Red spatters the floor already. I could drop you where you stand if I wanted, I tell her, remembering what I learned with the Electricons. Web lightning, storm lightning, but not Titan's impossible brain lightning, which I still have no control over. Evangeline shakes her head, smiling. She's enjoying this.
You're welcome to try.
I match her grin. Fine. My lightning erupts, purple and white, blinding, burning, hissing through air already damp with sweat. She reacts with near inhuman speed, her knives suddenly melded into a single, long band of steel. It pierces the floor as the lightning hits, making it ripple into the metal. It misses its mark with a flash that blinds even me. Then, her elbow cracks into my chin, throwing me backward. I see stars again. Nice trick, I mumble, rolling the blood around my mouth. When I spit this time, I think I hear a tooth ping off the floor. I confirm my suspicion with my tongue, feeling the sudden unfamiliar gap in my bottom teeth. Evangeline rolls her shoulders, her breath coming in uneven gasps. Had to even the playing field somehow. With a small grunt, she yanks the spear out of the floor and twists it around her wrist.
Finished warming up?
Slowly, I laugh. Oh, yes. I wait my turn, watching as Ren works on Evangeline's face. One of her eyes is swollen shut, colored a black and sickly gray purple that deepens with the passing minutes. The other eyelid twitches every few seconds, some busted nerve. She huffs at me, shoulders rising and falling, then winces, pressing a bloody hand to her side.
Stay still,
Ren mutters for the third time. She traces the side of Evangeline's face, and the swelling recedes in her wake.
You broke a rib.
Evangeline glares as best she can, with one barely working eye.
Good fight, Barrow.
Good fight, Samos, I answer with some difficulty. Between a split lip, the nose, and the bruised jaw, even talking stings. I have to lean, keeping my weight off my left ankle, which is steadily dripping blood from a neat gash above the knobbly exposed bone. The three men stand back, giving us all the space we need to breathe. Killorn looks between Evangeline and me, his mouth hanging open in disbelief, and maybe fear.
Girls are weird,
he mutters to himself. Tiberius and Ptolemus bob their heads, agreeing. I think Evangeline is trying to wink, or the twitch is worse than I thought. Maybe I'm exhausted from the fight, but I almost laugh. With her, not at her. The realization sobers me up, and the pulsing electric feel of adrenaline starts to fade. I can't forget who she is and what her family has done to mine. Her brother, sitting just a few feet away, killed Shade, robbed Clara of a father, Farley of a partner, took a son from my mother and father, stole a brother from me. And I've tried to do the same. Evangeline senses the shift in me, and her gaze drops, her face returning to carefully sculpted stone. Ren Skonos is skilled. Her skin healer abilities restore Evangeline to fighting shape in a few minutes. The two young women contrast each other, Evangeline with her braided silver hair and pale skin, Ren with a long braid of gleaming jet hair cast over one bare, blue-black shoulder. I don't miss the way Ptolemus watches the skin healer as she finishes up with his sister. His eyes linger on her neck, her face, her collarbone. Not her fingers or her handiwork. It's easy to forget he's married to Elaine. At least in name. Though I suppose his sister spends more time with his bride, while he spends his own with Ren.
What a confusing family.
Now you, Ren says, gesturing for me to take Evangeline's spot. The Samos princess stands, stretching out her newly healed abdomen with the grace of a cat. I sit gingerly, wincing as I do.
Big baby, Killorn chuckles.
In response, I grin aggressively, careful to show the new gap in my blood-stained teeth. He pretends to shudder. Ptolemus laughs at the display, earning a glare from both of us. Something funny? Killorn sneers, stepping closer to the silver-haired man. My friend is too brave for his own good, with no regard for the Magnetron prince who could cut him in two. Killorn, I'll be along in a second. I cut in loudly, hoping to kill any conflict before it starts. I don't fancy wiping Killorn's blood off the training floor. He glances at me, annoyed by my nannying, but I stay resolute. It's okay. Go on. Fine, he grinds out, careful to glare back at Ptolemus as he walks away. When the echo of his footsteps dies, Evangeline smoothly stands, her intentions clear. She barely smirks as she leaves us too, her brother in tow, and they head in a different direction. She glances over her shoulder. I catch her gaze as it flicks between me and Tiberius, who is still silent, hanging close. Hope flares in her eyes. It only makes my heart sink. It's a stupid plan, I want to say again. Relief pulses from Ren's fingers, soothing each aching muscle and blooming bruise. I shut my eyes, letting her prod and pull me in different directions. Ren is Sarah Skonos' cousin, a daughter of a noble house torn between two Kalor kings. She served Maven before, working as my healer in Archeon. She watched me through those days, kept me alive when the weight of Silent Stone would otherwise kill me, kept my face and my body presentable for Maven's broadcasts. Neither of us could predict where we would be today. Suddenly, I don't want the pain to go. It's an easy distraction from the want in my heart. As Ren's fingers dance along my jaw, stimulating bone growth to replace my lost tooth, I try not to picture Tiberius. But it's impossible. He's close enough to feel, the familiar warmth of him steady and constant. Before, Evangeline said I was the difficult one. I think she's wrong. If she trapped Tiberius and me in a room together, I'd probably snap. And would that be so terrible? You blush a great deal. My eyes wrench open to see Ren hovering in front of my face, her full lips pursed. She blinks at me, her eyes the same stormy gray as Sarah's. It's hot in here, I reply. Tiberius blushes too. We walk in silence. The glass walls of Ridge House look out on flat darkness, the long, clean lights of the passages bouncing back at us. Our reflections keep pace, and I'm struck by the sight of us, side by side. I never forget how tall he is, but this is a firm reminder of how ill-suited we are. Despite the training session, the sweat still clinging to his skin, Tiberius is a prince born, descended from 3 centuries of kings. He was bred to be better than anyone else, and it shows. I feel smaller than usual beside him, a dirty little speck of scars and heartache. He feels my gaze and glances down. So, Newtown. Sighing, I brace myself for the discussion. We need to do it, I reply. Not just for the war, but for us. Reds, the tech towns are little more than enslavement. I've never set foot inside one, but I've seen Greytown, a city of ash and smoke, crowded onto the poisoned riverbank. I've seen Cameron's neck and her brother's, both harshly tattooed with their assigned place, their profession, their prison. I intend to leave Newtown and the other slums as little more than corpses, empty, dead, doomed to rot and disappear and be forgotten. I know, Tiberius says softly, his voice tinged by blue regret. As I watch, his eyes darken. He knows what I'm really saying. If there were no crown between us, I would take his hand, kiss his shoulder, thank him for even such a small display of support. I bite my lip, blinking quickly to chase off the urge to touch. I'll need Cameron. Her name wakes him up. Is she alive? I offer, letting the word echo off the tumbled stone of the passageway. It lingers, a question as much as a hope. She has to be. He slows his pace.
Farley still hasn't heard anything?
She will soon. The Scarlet Guard contingents in Piedmont, now converging on the Low Country, to evacuate anyone who escaped the base, should have reports back in a matter of hours. And Iberum should have more intelligence to relay when Rash gets to the other survivors. There is no realm of possibility where Cameron isn't on the list. She's too strong, too smart, and too damn stubborn to get herself killed. I can't even entertain the idea. Not because we'll need her to help destroy her wretched home, Newtown, but because she'll be one more body on my conscience. Another friend I pushed toward death. I squeeze my eyes shut, trying not to think about the others who were still in Piedmont when Bracken took the base. Cameron's brother, Maury, the teenagers of the Dagger Legion, rescued from one siege, only to be caught in another. Nothing compares to the agony of losing Shade, but losing the others could destroy me just as easily. How long will this last? How many people will we risk losing? This is war, Mayor Barrow. You risk everyone, every single day. Especially the person next to me. I bite my lip, almost drawing blood, to stave off the thought of Tiberius, Cal, dead and gone.
It doesn't get easier,
he says, the words ragged. I open my eyes to find him staring ahead with the dogged focus he usually saves for a battlefield or a war council.
What? Losing people. He growls. There's never a moment where it goes away, no matter how many times it happens. You never get used to it.
An eternity ago, when I was Marina Titanos, I stood inside a prince's bedchamber. He had books all over the place. Manuals, treaties on war, strategy, diplomacy, maneuvers and manipulations for gigantic armies and single soldiers, calculations weighing the risk and reward. How many people could die, and yet he'd still be able to claim victory? Back then, it was a stark reminder of who he was and whose side he was on. It disgusted me to think of him as a person who would trade life so carelessly, spill blood for another inch of progress. Now, I've done the same thing. So has Farley. So has Davidson. None of us are innocent. None of us will ever be able to forget what we do in these days. If it never goes away, I murmur, feeling as if I might be drowned. It will eventually be too much.
Yeah,
he says hoarsely. I wonder how close he is to his line and how close I am to mine. Will we cross it on the same day? Is that the only answer? Do we walk away broken and beyond repair together or apart? His eyes smolder over me. I think he's asking himself the same thing. Shuddering, I quicken my steps, a firm signal to both of us. What's the plan for Harbor Bay? I ask, looking down the long hall. It bridges this wing of Ridge House to the next, arcing over a weaving garden of trees and fountains barely visible in the darkness. Tiberius matches my pace easily.
Nothing is set until Davidson comes back, but Farley has ideas, and her contacts in the city will certainly be of help.
I nod in agreement. Harbor Bay is the oldest city in Norta, a warren of red criminals and their gangs. A few months ago, one of those gangs, the Mariners, tried to sell us to Maven as we searched for new bloods. But the tide is changing. The Reds of Norta are falling into line as the Scarlet Guard grows in power and notoriety. Our victories are having an effect on some, at least.
There will be civilian casualties,
Tiberius adds, matter of fact.
It isn't Corvium or Piedmont. Harbor Bay is a city, not a fort. Innocent people, silver and red, will be stuck in the middle of this.
He flexes a hand, stretching out long, keen fingers before cracking his knuckles, one by one.
We'll start with Fort Patriot.
If we can take control there, the rest of the city will fall.
I've only seen Patriot from afar, and the memory is vague. It's smaller than the Piedmont base, but better equipped and far more important to Maven's armies.
Governor Rombos and his house are sworn to Maven, I reply. They're still firm allies.
Due in no small part to me, since I killed his son in the arena during a failed execution. Of course, he was also trying to kill me.
They won't surrender easily.
Tiberius scoffs.
No one ever does.
And if you win the city? I prod.
If you survive.
Then I think we can get Maven to the table.
The name sends a jolt through me. At my collarbone, Maven's brand smarts and warms, itching for attention.
He won't negotiate. He won't surrender at all.
I feel sick at the thought of Maven's empty eyes, his wicked smile, the cloying, unbreakable obsession plaguing us both.
There's no point in it, Tiberius.
He winces at my use of his full name, eyes sliding shut for a second.
That's not why I want to see him.
The implication is clear.
Oh.
I have to be sure,
he grinds out. I ask the Premier about whispers in his country, if there are any new bloods like Ilara, anyone who might be able to help him. And?
When I walked away from Tiberius in Corvium, he looked heartbroken, agonized.
This is no different. Love has a way of cutting us apart like nothing else.
He didn't think so,
he admits quietly.
But he said he would keep looking.
I lay a hand on his arm, still damp with sweat. My fingers know his skin as well as my own by now. He feels like quicksand. If I linger too long, I won't be able to escape. I try to be gentle. I doubt even Ilara could fix him now, if he would let her. His flesh flares hot beneath my hand and I pull away, remembering myself. He doesn't react. There's nothing he can say and nothing he has to say to me. I know what letting go of Maven Kalor looks like. The passage ahead of us dead ends at a T-shaped junction, trailing off to the left and right. His room's to one side, mine to the other. We stare at the wall in silence, neither of us daring to move. Speaking to him feels like a dream, a painful one. Even so, I don't want to wake up.
How long?
I whisper. He doesn't look at me.
Davidson will be here in a week's time. With another week to plan, his throat bobs. Not long.
The last time I set foot in Harbor Bay, we were on the run. But my brother was alive. I wish I could go back to those days, hard as they were.
I know what Evangeline's trying to do,
Tiberius says suddenly, his voice thick with too many emotions to place. I glance sidelong at him.
She's not exactly subtle about it.
He doesn't return the gesture, continuing to stare at the wall in front of us, never leaning one way or the other.
I wish there were some middle ground.
A place where our names and our blood and our pasts don't matter. A place without weight. A place that has never been and will never exist.
Good night, Tiberius.
Hissing, he clenches a fist.
I really need you to stop calling me that.
And I really need you.
I turn and walk toward my room, my footsteps echoing and alone.
17. Iris. Archaon will never be my home. Not because of the location, the size of the city, the lack of shrines and temples, or even my bone-deep, inborn disdain for Nortons. None of those things weigh as much as the emptiness I feel without my family at my side. It is a hole I try to fill with training, prayer, and my other queenly duties. Boring as some of them might be, but all are necessary. The most important is to stay in fighting shape. It would be easy to soften in my apartments of silk and velvet, waited on by red servants tripping over themselves to bring me anything I want. It was the same in the Lakelands, but I never wanted to find solace in food and alcohol the way I do here. My training sessions also set a good balance, so I don't fall into the trap so many royals and nobles find themselves in. A trap Maven baits well. Many of the lords and ladies still supporting his reign seem more preoccupied with his parties and feasts than they are with the wolves at the door. Idiots. Prayer is more difficult to come by in this godless country. There are no temples in Archeon that I know of, and the shrine I demanded be built for me here is small, a glorified closet tucked away in my apartments. Not that I need much space to commune with my nameless gods, but in the heat of high summer, the little room crowded with worn faces is hardly comfortable, even with my abilities circulating cool moisture through the air. I try to pray elsewhere, or at least feel my gods as the days pass, but it grows more difficult the longer I'm away from home. If I can't hear them, can they hear me? Am I infinitely alone? I suppose that is easier. I want no connection to Norta, nothing to tie me to this place when Maven's brother overthrows him, unless my mother does it first. My queenly duties are the only distraction from my isolation. Today my schedule takes me across the great bridge spanning the capital river, to the other side of the city, as far away from Maven as I can still get within the diamond glass walls of Archeon. He appears outside the palace less and less, occupying himself with endless councils or long hours alone. I hear the whispers of the servants. His clothes end up burned most days, charred beyond repair. It means he's losing control, or he doesn't care to keep himself in check. I think it could be both. East Archeon mirrors the western side of the city, rising up from the river's edge to the cliff-like banks that roll off into gentle slopes. Everything is green this time of year. That reminds me of home, at least, though little else does. Even the water is wrong. Salt, not fresh, and tainted with the whispers of pollution from the tech slum upstream. They think the barrier trees get the most of it, but any nymph would know better with a single sniff. The buildings here are tall and oppressive, all columns of granite and marble. Their roofs crowned in sculpted birds with splayed wings and arched necks, swans, falcons, eagles. Their feathers are copper and steel, polished to a blinding sheen. Even in the middle of a war, the capital itself carries on in ignorant bliss. Reds walk the streets, marked by their crimson bracelets or the colors of their employing houses. Silvers and their transports roll between their destinations. Museums, the galleries, the theater are all still in operation without change or delay. I suppose they're used to war, as the Lakelands are, even within the borders of their own kingdom. Today I'm attending a memorial luncheon to honor the soldiers lost when Maven's brother and his rebels took Corvium. My sentinels follow, as always, garish in their flaming robes. Though I wear my usual colors, a nod to my native home, my blue blouse and jacket are trimmed with Maven's black and red. I feel wrong painting myself like this, but no one would know from looking at me. I smile and nod with the best, trading idle conversation with the many lords and ladies who wish to favor their new queen. No one says anything of any real use. It's all for show, even with the families of those who died. They clearly don't want to be here, preferring to face their grief alone. Instead, they're trotted out like actors in a performance, put on display. One after the other explains how their loved ones died, all murdered by some red terrorist or Montfort freak. A few are barely able to finish their speeches. A clever tactic, one I'm sure my husband is behind. Anyone who might oppose this war, or even prefer Maven's brother on the throne, would have a difficult time holding to their convictions after such a show. And I play my part in it well enough. We are here today to mourn, but also to send a message. We will not be controlled by fear, I say as firmly as I can, staring out at a chamber crowded with sharp-eyed lords and ladies. They look on with rapt attention, either to be polite or to look for cracks, hunt for weakness. Many, I know, would abandon Maven's Norta if they thought it was the right play for their houses. It's my job to convince them otherwise, to stay, to fight, to die. We will not give in to the will of rebels and terrorists, and power-hungry criminals hiding behind false promises. We will not throw away everything our country is, our ideals, what Norta is built on, what our very lives are built on. My elocution lessons come to mind. Although I was never as talented at speechcraft as Tiora, I do my best. Holding a dozen gazes at once, never flinching, never stumbling. I clench a fist at my side, hidden in my skirts. Norta is a silver country, born from our strength, our power, our achievements, and our sacrifices. No red will take what we have or change who we are. They are nothing to us, no matter who their allies are. Maven Kalor will prevail. True Norta will prevail. Strength and power. I bite back a grin as I slip familiar words into the previously approved speech. Let them face our flood. Despite all my restraint, I can't help but smile as the crowd claps and cheers for Lakelander words, my mother's words. Get used to it, Nordens. You'll bow to my colors soon enough. The heat wave is broken, making the walk back to my waiting convoy of transports pleasant. I want to linger on the street, enjoying the fresh air and gentle sunlight, and I move as slowly as I can. My sentinels edge me along, their gloved hands and masked faces flanking me in practiced formation. We're ahead of schedule, by my count. I only have to return to the palace and prepare for tonight's dinner. Still, the open transport door comes too quickly. With a huff, I step up and in, my eyes downcast as the door shuts behind me. Good afternoon, Your Majesty. Two faces stare back from inside the transport, on the seats across from mine. One is familiar, and one I can guess at. Both are enemies. I yelp, sliding back against the leather seating. On instinct, I reach for the canteen of water I keep close. My other hand scrambles for the pistol under the back seat. Fingers catch me under my chin, forcing me to look up. I expect them to belong to the singer, the uncle who can murmur away all thought in my head, turn me inside out. Instead, I look up to find it's the grandmother who holds me, her bronze eyes alight and determined. I freeze, knowing exactly what Annabelle Lareland's touch can do. I picture her grip changing, shifting, and then my skull exploding open, spewing brain and bone all over the transport interior. Some advice from one queen to another, my dear, Annabelle says, still holding my chin. Do not do anything stupid. Fine, I whisper, showing my empty palms. No gun, no canteen, no weapons but the air in the transport with us. I glance over her shoulder at the silhouette of my driver and the sentinel guard, both on the other side of the glass. Julian Jacobs follows my gaze, then sighs. He wraps his knuckles on the divider. Neither of my guards moves.
They won't be able to hear you for some time, I'm afraid, he says. And they've been instructed to take the scenic route back to the palace.
With an empty smile, he peeks out the window as we weave down unfamiliar alleys.
We're not here to hurt you, Iris.
Good. I didn't think you were foolish enough to try, I shoot back, a little impeded by Annabelle's lethal grip. Do you mind? I sneer at her. With a patronizing bow of her head, she releases me, but doesn't back away, keeping me within easy reach. Under my clothes, I try to gather moisture on my skin, pulling it from the air, and the cold, terrified sweat breaking out over my body. Maybe I can get some kind of shield ready if she tries to obliterate my fingers. If you want to send Maven a message, use the proper channels, I toss at her, throwing up a brazen wall of attitude. She scoffs, looking disgusted.
This isn't a message for that wretched brat.
Your grandson, I remind her. She scowls but carries on,
I want you to pass along a word to your mother, the way you usually do. Sniffing, I cross my arms. I don't know what you're talking about. Annabelle rolls her eyes and exchanges glances with Julian. He is far more difficult to read, his expression still and studious.
I don't need to sing a confession out of you, Julian says plainly. But you know I can, if need be.
I say nothing, do nothing. My face is still as the surface of an undisturbed pond. No confirmation either way. The Lairland woman barrels on anyway, looking down her nose at me.
Tell the Queen of the Lakelands that the rightful King of Norta has no quarrel with her, and every intention of preserving the peace his usurper negotiated. That is, of course, if assurances can be made.
You want us to stand down? I sneer at her. She regards me with equal disdain. An impossible thing.
No, not stand down. Appearances must be maintained, of course, Annabelle says, splaying those wretched fingers.
I watch each one as they drum a rhythm against her leg.
But I'm sure we can find some compromise other than open war between our two sovereigns.
Once more I glance at my guards behind glass, bewitched into ignoring us. The road through the window is unfamiliar, to me at least. I grit my teeth.
He is no sovereign. Our alliance is not with Tiberius Calor, a traitor to his kingdom and his kind.
The uncle tips his head to one side, surveying me like a painting. He blinks slowly.
Your husband is better at that lie than you are.
Husband. The reminder of my place here and my position at Maven's side is an easy jab, but it stings nonetheless.
Lie or not, the people believe it, I hiss back at him. Red and silver, all over this country. They believe what they are told, and they will fight for the person they think Maven is.
To my surprise, Annabelle nods. Her face falls, a picture of concern.
That's what we're afraid of, and that's why we're here, to prevent as much bloodshed as we can.
Annabelle Lerilan, you should have been an actress, I chuckled darkly. She just waves a hand, glancing out the window. Her lips curve into the ghost of a smile.
I was a great patroness of the arts a lifetime ago.
For some reason, Julian glances at her, his eyes softening. She glances back, oddly reserved. Something passes between them, an unspoken word or a shared memory, perhaps. Annabelle recovers first, looking back to me. Her voice is stern, and I feel scolded without a reprimand.
When Tiberius wins the throne, he is prepared to offer land and money in exchange for Lakelander cooperation.
I raise one eyebrow, the only indication of any interest. After all, who knows where this might lead? Keeping options open is smart. She knows what I'm doing and pushes on.
The entirety of the choke ceded over.
Again, I have to laugh, tossing back my head. The moisture against my skin, an almost shield, prickles against me.
Useless land, I scoff. A minefield. You're gifting us with a chore.
The old queen pretends not to hear me.
And a betrothal to Tiberius's heir, a child of Calor and Samos, twice royal, an heir to two kingdoms.
For appearance sake, I keep laughing, but my stomach churns with revulsion. She's trying to barter with an unborn child, either mine or Tiora's. Our own flesh and blood. Consent be damned. At the very least, I agreed to my own arrangement. But doing the same to a baby? Disgusting.
And what about your red dogs? I ask, leaning forward into her territory.
It's my turn to push back.
The Scarlet Guard? The blood freaks of Montfort? Mare Barrow and her kind?
Julian answers before Annabelle can. She doesn't seem pleased, either by his manner or by his intent.
You mean the next step in our evolution, he says. It isn't wise to fear the future, Your Majesty. That never ends well.
Futures can be prevented, Lord Jacobs. I think of the other new blood pet Maven lost, the one who could see too far into the future. I only heard rumors of him, but the rumors were enough. He could see every path as it changed, even fates that would never come to fruition.
Not this one.
Julian shakes his head. I can't tell if he's happy or regretful. The man is an odd, sad soul. Tormented by a woman, no doubt, as most men like him are.
Not now.
I look between them and do not like what I see. Each could kill me if they wanted, and despite all my training, I would go down easily. But if they were here to murder me, they would have done it already. You've lost Piedmont, so you want the Lakelands, I mutter. You know you can't win without one of us doing your dirty work.
We do enough dirty work of our own, Princess,
Annabelle replies, her voice low and annoyed. She puts emphasis on my born title. She doesn't recognize Maven as king, so she wouldn't see me as a queen. You put so much stock in your Montfort shield, I tell them both. Are their new bloods really enough to outweigh the might of our three nations? Julian folds his hands in his lap, thoughtful. He is more difficult to unsettle.
I think we all know that the full might of the Lakelands will never come to the aid of Maven Kalor.
That smarts a little. I was stupid before, signaling what I did to Mare through that new blood in the Piedmont prison, for no reason other than to prove I could. Clearly she passed on the message. Or maybe we're simply that transparent. I bristle, firing back.
Just as we all know your Red Alliance will not last, that it is another powder keg close to open flame.
This does make Julian uncomfortable. He shifts, thrown off balance, and a slight gray tinge colors his cheeks. Not so with Annabelle. She thrives, grinning, as if I've just served her a delicious meal. Even though I don't know how, I feel as if I've misstepped. The woman puts out her hand, and I jerk back, out of her grasp. She seems amused by my fear.
There is something else we can offer.
Julian's blush deepens, and he frowns, dropping his gaze, breaking eye contact with me, essentially putting down his only weapon. I could move against him right now and get the upper hand, but Annabelle is too close, too lethal. And I have to admit, I want to know what the last piece of her bargain is. Go on, I breathe, almost inaudible. Her smile is wide, pointed, and while Maven is his mother's son, I see some of him in his grandmother, in the sharp grin and the scheming mind.
Salin Iral put a knife in your father's back, she says.
I flinch at the memory.
I assume you would like to have a conversation with him.
I respond without thinking. A mistake. I can think of some things I would like to say, yes, I mutter quickly. A phantom taste of blood fills my mouth.
I'm sure you know why it was done, she says.
Pain pricks at my edges. My father's death is still an open, oozing wound.
Because this is war, people die.
Her dark eyes, like molten bronze, widen.
Because Salin Iral did as he was commanded to do.
Any sorrow I feel for my loss steadily turns to rage. It licks up my spine, hot and begging.
Volo,
I can't help but hiss. The name of the Samos king sours in my mouth. But Annabelle knows how to push me.
Would you like to speak with him too? She breathes,
almost seductive in her offer. At her side, Julian returns his gaze to me, his lips pressed together. The lines of his face seem to deepen. I drag a long breath through my teeth.
Yes, I certainly would, I breathe.
What is your price? Grinning, she tells me. They melt into the city like ghosts, simply stepping out of the transport at the crowded corner,
disappearing into the ranks of red servants and more common silvers. My guards don't seem to notice or mind, falling back into our pre-scheduled route. Julian Jacos did his work well, and when I return to the palace, nothing seems amiss. None of my guards seem to realize they've lost 20 minutes to the abyss of a stranger's charm. I make a quick escape, intending to go to the shrine tucked away in my rooms, needing the familiar and blissfully empty space to collect my thoughts. Mother must be informed of everything that just transpired, and as soon as possible. But I can't trust that my message won't be intercepted, even through the deepest back channels. Annabelle's offer could get me beheaded, burned, mutilated, and murdered. This message can only be passed face to face. I manage to get up to my room safely. With a wave of dismissal, I leave my sentinels at the door to my chambers, as usual. Only when I'm truly alone do I realize what I've done and what has just happened. I start to shake, my hands trembling as I step through my receiving salon. My pulse races. I think of Salin Iral and Volo beneath my hands, drowning, dying, paying the ultimate price for what they did to my father.
Traffic on the bridge.
I freeze, eyes wide. His voice always puts a fear in me, especially when it comes from my bedroom. My instincts tell me to run, damn myself, escape the city somehow, find a way home. An impossible thought. I force myself forward instead, through the double doors leading into my sleeping chamber, into what could be my coffin. Maven lazes across the sprawl of my silk blanket, one hand tucked behind his head, the other resting on his chest. His fingers drum in time, bone white against one of his thousands of black shirts. He seems bored and angry, a bad combination.
Good afternoon, wife, he says.
I glance around the room at the many fountains I keep close, not for decoration, but my own protection. I feel each as it ripples and chases, more than enough to use should this turn ugly. If he knows what I've done, what I entertained, what I agreed to do.
What are you doing here?
No use playing the part of doting wife, not while we're alone. He'll know something is wrong if he doesn't already. Or, I realize with a cold chill, he could simply be here to fulfill our marital duties, neglected as they've been. I'm not sure what terrifies me more. Even though I agreed to this, knew this was part of the bargain, knew he was part of our alliance. Perhaps I have overestimated his obsession with Mare, or it has simply worn away. He turns his head to look at me, one cheek pressed against the silk. A flop of black hair falls across his forehead. He seems younger today, albeit more manic. His eyes are barely blue, overtaken by wide black pupils.
I need you to send word to the Lakelands, he says. To your mother.
Stay still. Don't move. Don't show any relief, I tell myself, even as my knees threaten to give out.
To say what, exactly? I reply, donning a mask of indifference.
He moves gracefully, standing with smooth motions. Though Tiberius is the warrior brother, Maven is not without his own physical skill.
Walk with me, Iris, he says,
smiling sharply. I have no choice but to obey. However, I ignore his outstretched arm, keeping a safe distance of a few inches between us. He doesn't speak, forcing us to walk in silence as we leave my rooms together. I feel dangled on the end of a string, suspended over a pit. My heart hammers in my chest, and I do everything I can to maintain my mask through long minutes of walking. Only when we reach the throne room, empty at this time of day, does he turn to look at me. I brace myself for the blow, preparing to fight back.
Tell your mother to prepare her fleet and her armies, he says, as if remarking on my dress.
Surprise replaces my fear. He keeps walking, mounting the raised steps to pass behind the throne. I edge around the influence of Silent Stone. Even the brush of it makes me gulp.
What? Now?
I sputter,
raising a hand to my throat. My mind races as I study Maven, looking for the lie. It's barely been a week since Bracken took back Piedmont. Surely the Brothers' coalition is still regrouping. Are we under attack?
Not at the moment.
He shrugs, indifferent, and still moving, still drawing me along after him.
But soon enough.
I narrow my eyes, feeling unease deep in my gut. Maven approaches one of the doors behind the throne, heading for what are supposed to be the Queen's public chambers. A library, a study, sitting rooms. I don't use them, preferring my shrine instead. He passes through, and I have to follow. How do you know that? I ask. Dread pulls in my stomach. He shrugs again. The room is dark, the windows heavily curtained. I can barely make out the stripes of white and navy blue, the colors of the last queen to use this place. These rooms have an air of dust and disuse.
I know my brother, Maven says. What's more, I know what he needs, and what this country needs from him.
And that is? He smirks at me, opening another door across the sitting area. His teeth flash in the semi-darkness. He does all he can to seem a predator. Something about the next room makes me pause, makes me ache deep in my marrow. I keep still, seemingly unaffected, but my heart pounds. Maven? I murmur.
Cal has allies, but not enough. Not in Norda.
The young king drums his fingers together, his eyes glazing as he thinks out loud. He remains in the doorway, on the edge, never stepping through.
He wants to sway more of my subjects to his side, but he isn't a diplomat. Cal is a warrior, and he'll fight to win favor among the high houses. To show how worthy he is of my crown, he has to tip the scales. Make the nobles believe he isn't a hopeless cause.
Maven isn't stupid. Predicting the movements of his opponents is his strong suit, and the only reason he's been able to survive and win for this long. I never take my eyes off the doorway, straining to see what it holds. The room beyond is pitch black. So he'll attack another city. Maybe even the capital. Maven tisks like I'm a stupid child in the classroom. I fight back the urge to stick his head into the nearest fountain.
My brother and his coalition intend to strike Harbor Bay.
How can you be sure? The king purses his lips.
It's his best option. The fort, the ships in port, not to mention its sentimental value, he adds, spitting out the words with revulsion. His mother loved that city.
His fingers play with the latch on the open door. It's a strong-looking lock, more complicated than it should be. I swallow hard. If Maven thinks Cal will go for Harbor Bay, I believe him. And I don't want my mother or our armies anywhere near the conflict. Excuses spring up in my head, ready to wield. Our fleet is still in the lakes, I offer, sounding apologetic. It will take time. Maven doesn't seem surprised or even concerned by my words. He passes closer to me, his hands inches from mine. I can feel the sickly heat of his skin.
I expected as much, he says. So I'll give your royal mother some incentive.
My stomach twists. Oh? His smile flashes. I hate it.
Have you ever been to Harbor Bay, Iris?
No, Maven. If I were a lesser person, untrained, my voice would tremble. Not with the fear he wants from me, but with rage. It ripples through me, furious as a storm. Maven doesn't seem to notice or care.
I certainly hope you enjoy the visit, he says, still grinning.
So I'm bait? I hiss.
I would never call you bait, but incentive.
He heaves a sigh.
Yes, I believe I did call you that.
How dare you? He speaks over me, his voice louder than before.
With you in the city, ready to lead the defense, I'm certain your mother will do all she can to uphold her end of our alliance. Don't you agree?
He doesn't wait for me to answer, and his voice turns ragged. A fist clenches at his side.
I need the armies I was promised. I need reinforcements. I need nymphs in the harbor to drown that city and everyone in it.
Hastily I nod, if only for the sake of placating him. I'll tell her. But I can't guarantee. Maven closes the distance between us, and I tense. His fist closes over my wrist, grip tight, as he pulls me forward. I bite back the instinct to fight. It will only end in pain.
Just as I cannot guarantee your safety there, he says, stopping just short of the dark doorway.
His lips twitch, amused.
Or even here.
At some hidden signal, the doorway behind us crowds with a troop of sentinels. They are all broad, masked, and robed, glittering in their black jewels and flaming silks. My guards, and my jailers. I realize what this is, what the next room, the black place where Maven stands so easily, is supposed to be. His throne isn't the only thing here made of silent stone. The threat gleams, the edge of a razor pressed against my neck. His grip tightens, fingers cold on my skin. There will be no running from Maven's commands.
And what about you, my brave and just king? I snarl, still staring into the black room.
I can just feel it, the numbing edge of stone. He doesn't rise to the insult. He's too smart for that.
Don your armor, Iris. Wait for the storm. And hope your mother moves as quickly as my brother can.
18. Mare. There are no stars this close to Newtown. The sky around the slum is permanently choked with a haze of pollution. It smells foul and poisonous, even on the outskirts, where the noxious fog is thinnest. I draw up the kerchief around my neck, breathing through the fabric instead. The other soldiers around me do the same, pulling faces at the toxic air. But not Cameron. She's used to it. Relief washes over me every time I look at Cameron, her lean, dark form moving nimbly through the pitch-black forest. She's so tall, easy to pick out among the dozens moving with us. Killorn keeps close to her side, his silhouette familiar. As I watch the pair of them, my relief quickly melts to shame. Cameron escaped the Piedmont base, fleeing into the swamps with her brother and a few dozen more survivors. Many died where she did not. Red soldiers of the Dagger Legion, children we swore to keep safe. New bloods of Montfort, new bloods of the Notch, silvers, reds. So many dead it makes my head spin. And I'm sending her right back into danger. Thanks for doing this, Cam. I murmur, my voice almost inaudible, as if a simple thank you means anything. With a grin, she glances over her shoulder at me. Her teeth gleam in the weak light of our lanterns. In spite of the dire circumstances, I've never seen her smile like she does tonight. As if you could get this done without me, she whispers back, almost teasing. But don't thank me, Barrow. I've been dreaming about a day like this since I was a little girl. Newtown is not going to know what bleeding hit it. No, it will not. I mutter to myself, thinking of the morning ahead of us. Fear and nerves carve me up, as they did on the flight from the rift. We're about to storm the tech slum she was born in, a place hemmed in by walls and guards and decades of oppression. And we're not the only assault on the move. Miles to the east, the rest of our coalition is heading toward Harbor Bay. The rift soldiers will attack from the sea, with the Laris fleet ready on the wing. Tiberius and Farley are in the tunnels by now, ready to lead the main bulk of the army up into the city. I try to picture the three-pronged assault in my mind. It's nothing like any battle I've survived before. Neither is this, separated from the Fire Prince, from Farley, from so many dear to me. At least I have faithful Killorn still resolute at my side. There is some symmetry here, I guess. We return to who we were before, creeping in alleys, clad in dirty clothes, our faces obscured and unfamiliar. Shadows. Rats. Rats with sharper teeth and longer claws. These trees are rotting, Cameron says aloud, drawing a hand down the black bark of a barrier tree, one of thousands in this cursed forest. Created by green wardens, the trees were meant to trap and filter out pollution from the slum. They ring all the tech towns, marching up to their walls. Whoever grew these doesn't care to maintain them. Whatever they're supposed to do, they aren't really doing it anymore. They think they're just poisoning us, she continues, her voice seething. They're poisoning themselves, too. We move under the cover of Haven shadows and the muffling ability of Farah, one of my old New Blood recruits from the Notch. Instead of disguising our 50 troops individually, they mask us as a group, throwing their abilities over us like a blanket. We're invisible and inaudible to anyone outside their circle of influence, able to pass in plain sight. We can see and hear one another, but no one a few yards away can see or hear us. Premier Davidson steps softly behind me, flanked by his own guards. The vast majority of the Montfort army will assault Harbor Bay, but a few key new bloods are here with him. They don't have their usual uniforms. Even Ella, Titan, and Rafe have their hair covered, wrapped in scarves or a hat. They all blend in with the rest of us, dressed in discards, rags, hastily patched jackets and threadbare pants, all tech-issue clothing, courtesy of the Whistles Network smugglers in Harbor Bay. I wonder if a thief passed them on, a girl with no other choice than to steal, no other way to survive. The air thickens as we approach, and more than a few of us cough, gagging on the taste of smoke and fumes. The sickly sweet scent of gasoline settles over us, as if the dirt beneath our feet is saturated with it. Overhead, the greasy red leaves of the barrier trees tremble in a slight wind. Even in darkness, they look like blood. Mare. Killorn nudges my arm. Wall's coming up, he says in warning. I can only nod in thanks, squinting through the trees. Indeed, the squat, thick walls of Newtown loom ahead, not as impressive as the diamond glass of a royal palace or as intimidating as the high stone walls of a silver city, but still an obstacle to overcome. Leadership suits Cameron, though she'll never admit it. She squares her shoulders as we approach, drawing herself up to her towering height. I wonder if she's even turned 16 yet. No teenager should be as calm, collected, and fearless as she is. Watch your feet, she hisses over my head, letting the message pass through our ranks. With a click, she switches on her dim, red flashlight. The rest of us follow suit, except for the Haven shadows. They only deepen their focus, masking the hellish glow. The tunnels come up behind the tree line. Drag your toes. Look for thick undergrowth. We do as she says, though Killorn covers far more ground than I do. He kicks his long legs through the dead and rotting leaves, feeling for the telltale hardness of a trap door.
Don't suppose you remember exactly where it is, do you?
He grumbles at Cameron. She looks up from a crouch on the ground, her hands in the leaves. I've never been in the tunnels before, she huffs, not old enough to make the smuggle runs. Besides, that's not my family's way, she adds, her eyes narrowing. Keep your bleeding head down. That's what we held to, and see where it got us?
Digging through the dirt for a hole, Killorn answers. I hear the smirk in his voice.
Leading an army, I offer instead. That's where you got yourself, Cameron. Her expression changes, tightening, but her lips pull into something close to a smile. A sad one. I understand it. She said before in Corvium that she was done with the killing, done with the lethal burden of her ability to silence and suffocate. Her goal now is to protect. Defend. though she has more cause than most to feel rage, to seek vengeance. She has the infinite strength to turn away. I don't. The tunnels glow with our red light, bathing us all in crimson, even the silver sworn to Cal or the Rift. The Haven shadows, the Aral silks, a dozen of them, scattered into our number, all of them for a moment, red as the dawn. I keep an eye on them as we walk, passing beneath the walls of Newtown. They have orders from their lords and kings. I don't trust them, not by a long shot, but I trust their allegiances. Silvers are loyal to blood. They do as blood commands. And we are not helpless, either. Ella and Rafe bring up the rear of our number. Both seem energized by our mission, itching for another fight after our defeat in Piedmont. Titan walks closer to the middle of our party, letting me take the lead, so that the electrocons are evenly dispersed. His eyes seem to glow in the low light. Cameron taps her hand at her hip, counting steps. Her keen eyes watch the walls with blistering focus. She slides a finger over the place where the packed dirt fades to concrete. It shifts something in her, shadowing her features. I know what it feels like, I whisper to her, to come back as something else. Her eyes snap to mine, one brow raised. What are you talking about? I only went home once after I found out what I was, I explain. It was only a few hours, but more than enough time to change my life again. Remembering that visit to my old village is difficult, if not painful. Shade wasn't dead yet, but I thought he was, and I joined the Scarlet Guard to avenge him, all while Tiberius waited outside, leaning against his rebuilt cycle. Still a prince. Always a prince. I tried to shake off the memory like a bad dream. It won't be easy to look at familiar things and see something you don't recognize. Cameron only tightens her jaw. This isn't my home, Barrow. No prison is ever a home, she murmurs, and that's all these slums are. So why not leave? I want to smack Killorn for his lack of grace, as well as for the rudeness of the question. He catches my glare and sputters, I mean, you have these tunnels. I'm surprised by her answering grin. You wouldn't understand, Killorn, she says, shaking her head with a roll of her eyes. You think you grew up hard, but this is harder. You thought you were tethered to that river village, trapped by what? A little money, a job, some guards looking at you sideways? He flushes deeper as she rattles off each word in time. Well, we had this. Her hand strays to her collar, pulling it aside to show her tattooed neck in full. Her occupation, her place, her prison, stamped in permanent ink. NT-ARSM-188907. Every one of us is a number up there, Cameron continues, jabbing a finger at the ceiling. You disappear, the next number in line disappears too, and not well. Whole families have to run. And where do they go? Where can they go? Her voice trails off, the echo dying in the red shadows. I hope that's in the past now, she mumbles, if only to herself. I promise it is, Davidson replies from a polite distance. His angled eyes crinkle when he tries to offer a bitter smile. If nothing else, the premiere is a firm reminder of what can be, how high someone like us can climb. Cameron and I exchange glances. We want to believe him. We have to believe him. I tie my kerchief tighter into place, blinking harsh tears out of my eyes. The air itself seems to burn, and my skin smarts. It's both dry and damp at the same time, unnatural and just plain wrong. It isn't dawn yet, but the smoky sky is lighter than it was before, as the sun begins its approach from the east. A high-pitched electric whistle blows at the end of the alley, then echoes out over the slum, from one factory to another, signaling the massive migration that is the shift change. The dawn walk. Cameron mutters. The sight makes my breath catch. Hundreds of red workers flood the streets of Newtown. Men and women and children, dark-skinned and pale-faced, old and young, all trudging together through the poisoned air, like some grim parade. Most look at their feet, exhausted by their work, broken by this place. It feeds the rage always burning in my heart. Cameron slips into their midst, with Killorn and me on her heels. Behind us, the rest of our band melts into the countless dirty faces, blending in with ease. I look back, finding Davidson, who follows at a safe distance. In the growing light, his face tightens, betraying the slight lines of age and care worn into his skin. He fists one hand into his jacket, close to his heart, and gives me a curt nod. Our steady parade of workers empties onto another street, wider than the rest, lined with stoic block apartments, organized like regimented soldiers. Another factory shift hurries toward us from the opposite direction, intent on taking our place. Gently, Cameron nudges me to the side, moving me in line with the rest of the red tech workers. They step quickly, in time with one another, creating space for the new shift to pass. As they do, Cameron shoves her fist into her own jacket as Davidson did. So do I, marking ourselves. The escorts are not Scarlet Guard, or they weren't before all this started. Their allegiances are to one another, to their slum, to small resistances, the only kind possible in here. Ours is a tall, black-skinned man, willowy like Cameron, his hair braided and pulled back into a tight, neat bun streaked with shades of gray. Cameron's foot taps as he approaches, her body almost radiating energy. He reaches us and clasps her arm. Daddy. I hear her breathe as he pulls her into an embrace. Where's Mama? He covers her hand with his own. She's coming off shift. I told her to keep her head down and her eyes open. First bolt of lightning, she's running. Cameron exhales slowly. She dips her head, nodding to herself. The dark around us continues to lift, fading to lighter shades of blue as dawn approaches. Good. I hope you didn't bring Maury here, her father adds, his tone light but scolding. And so familiar. It reminds me of my own parents, chiding me for a broken plate. Cameron's head snaps back to find her father staring, eyes a dark and deep black. Of course not. Even though I don't want to interrupt their reunion, I have to. The power station? I prod, looking up at the elder Cole. He glances down at me. He has a kind face, no mean feat in a place like this. NT has six, one for each sector, but if we cut off the central hub, that will do the job. Mention of the plan snaps something in Cameron. She straightens, focuses. This way, she says sharply, beckoning to us. The shift change is much more crowded than even the worst days in the Stilts market. Silver officers in black uniforms keep watch, not on the ground, on the filthy streets, but from the overarching walkways and windows of foreboding guard posts. Officers and posts I know well enough. I watch them as I pass, noting their disinterest. It's not the same disinterest Silvers show us at court, their way of making us feel like less than we already are, but a boredom, a disuse. Silvers aren't assigned to slum towns because they're warriors of important bloodlines. This isn't a post anyone would envy. The guards of Newtown are far weaker than any enemy I'm used to, and they have no idea we're already here. Cameron's father looks her over, thoughtful as we walk. I shiver when his gaze passes over me, then back to his daughter.
So, it's true, then. You're something different.
I wonder what he's heard, what the Scarlet Guard told their contacts in Newtown. Maven's propaganda and poisoned broadcasts made clear the existence of New Bloods. Does he know what his daughter can do? She holds his stare, his equal. I am, she says without flinching.
You walk with the lightning girl.
I do, she replies. And this is, he adds, eyeing Killorn. With a loopy grin, Killorn touches his brow and angles himself into a shallow bow. I'm the muscle. Mr. Cole almost laughs as he takes in Killorn's tall but lean form. Sure, kid. The buildings around us grow higher, stacked precariously. There are cracks in the walls and windows, and every block needs a fresh coat of paint, or just the good wash of a rainstorm. The workers around us start to peel off, heading into different apartment structures with waves and calls. Nothing seems amiss. We're grateful for your help, Mr. Cole. I say under my breath, keeping my focus ahead. A few silver guards stand on an arch some yards away, and I lower my face as we pass. Thank the elders, not me. Mr. Cole answers. He doesn't bother hiding from the guards. He's nothing to them. They've been ready for this for a long time. My throat tightens in shame. Because someone should have done something a long time ago. Someone like you, Tiberius. You knew these places existed. And for who? For what? Cameron grits her teeth. At least we're doing something now. At her side, she clenches a fist. With her ability, she could kill the two guards above us if she wanted, drop them right off the arch. But we pass by without incident, stepping into the shadow of the slouching gray slum apartment building at the end of the residential street. It looks like the toy blocks of a giant child, piled high against the hazy blue. One section is taller than the rest, dotted with grimy, dim windows. It's where we need to be. Mr. Cole glances at me, then at the structure. Up you go, Lightning Girl, he says, his voice soft. Get high, get loud. That's the plan, isn't it? Yes, sir, I mumble. Already I call to the lightning, feeling it respond deep in my bones. When we reach the base of the building, we're almost alone on the street, joined only by shift stragglers. Cameron turns to her father, eyes wide. How much time do we have? He turns over his wrist and glances at his watch. Then, Mr. Cole frowns, the lines cutting deep. None, he says. You have to go. She blinks rapidly, her jaw working. Okay. Sir, I believe this is yours, Killorn says, reaching into his jacket. He pulls free a small pistol and extra rounds of ammunition, neat in their case. Mr. Cole looks at the gun like a snake that might bite. He hesitates until Cameron takes it from Killorn and presses it to his chest. She widens her eyes, pleading. Point and click, Daddy. Don't hesitate, she says with furious need. Silvers won't. Slowly, gingerly, he tucks the gun away into the satchel at his side. As he turns, I catch sight of the tattoo on his neck. Fine, he breathes, dazed. I think all this is starting to catch up with him. Then he clears his throat. The new shift techs at the hub are informed. They'll power down the city with your first strike after the signal crossed town. Coordinate the systematic shutoff with your storm. Silvers won't know we're in on it. Buy some time. This part of the plan was eagerly arranged by both the Scarlet Guard and their contacts within the slum city. Everyone knows about the charges? I ask, if only to be sure. The Scarlet Guard who slipped in with us are already scattered around the city, planting their bombs, laying our traps. Cole's expression darkens, and he scowls. Everyone who can be trusted. We might have our own resistance, but we've got informants all over. I swallow hard, trying not to think what might happen if the wrong person knew what was about to happen. Maven himself might descend on Newtown and crush our insurgency, bring this poisoned, polluted ground smashing down on us all. And if we fail here, where will that leave the other slum cities? What will it prove? That nothing can be done, that these people can't be saved. Killorn notes my unease and nudges my shoulder, if only to snap me out of it. Cameron is, understandably, more concerned with her father. Okay, she says. Just watch where you bleeding step. Cole clucks his tongue. Don't curse, Cam. Without warning, Cameron smiles and throws her long arms around her father's neck, hugging him tightly. Kiss Mama for me. I hear her murmur. You'll kiss her yourself soon enough. He whispers back, lifting her slightly off the ground. Their eyes shut in unison as they hold on to each other, and this fragile, fleeting moment. I can't help but think of my family, so far away, safe, tucked up in the mountains, protected by thousands of miles and another country sworn to fight with us, living with hope for the first time in too many years. It isn't fair, especially to Cameron, who has survived far worse than I have. But I'm glad I don't have to shoulder the burden of my family's safety alongside everything else. I can barely handle the danger to the people I love who are still fighting. Cameron pulls away from her father first. It's an act of untold strength, as is letting her go. Mr. Cole steps back, sniffing, looking at his feet, hiding a sudden redness around his eyes. Tears prick at Cameron, too, and she scuffs her boot against the dirty street, kicking up dust in distraction. Shall we? She says, turning to me. Her eyes are wet. Let's climb. We watch the city with hawk focus, each of us at a window looking out in a different direction. I wipe at the glass with my sleeve. It only moves the grime around, leaving brown streaks. The attic space fogs with dust every time we move, kicking up another cloud. Killorn coughs into his hand, a hoarse sound. I could see smoke on this side, in between those factories, he says. At her window, Cameron raises a shoulder. Auto works sector, she replies without turning around. The assembly line's jammed half an hour ago. The shift will be turned out, and they'll idle around the gates asking for the day's wage. Overseers will refuse. Officers will try to keep peace. She grins to herself. Big mess. What color is the smoke, Killorn? I ask, still scanning my section of horizon. From this height, Newtown seems smaller, but just as depressing. All gray and smoggy, hung with low clouds of brutal haze. It pulses, sluggish, the electricity almost overwhelming. Normal? Killorn sputters. Gray? I huff low in my throat, eager to get this moving. Normal. Just the smokestacks, Cameron drawls. Not the signal. He shifts, coughing some more. I wince at the hacking sound. What are we looking for again? Anything that isn't normal, I reply through gritted teeth. Right, he grumbles. On the opposite side of the low room, Cameron taps her knuckles against her greasy window. You know, maybe this rebellion would be further along if they didn't rely on teenagers so much. She tosses a smirk at Killorn, especially ones who can't read. He barks out a laugh, rising to the bait. I can read. But colors are beyond your bleeding comprehension? She snaps back with whip quickness. He shrugs and raises his hands. I'm just making conversation. Cameron scoffs, rolling her eyes. Because we really need distractions right now, Killorn. I press my lips together, trying not to giggle at them both. Is this what Tiberius and I sound like when we argue? I ask with a raised brow. Because if so, I sincerely apologize. Killorn goes scarlet, flushing, as Cameron quickly turns back to her window, almost pressing her face to the glass. I missed what was happening with Shade and Farley. Have I missed this, too? You two are about 10 times worse, Killorn finally says, his voice a low, rumbling grunt. At the opposite window, Cameron snorts, You mean 100. Grinning, I glance between the pair of them. Both are on edge, even for the circumstances. I try to read the tightness in Killorn's shoulders, but the flush still coloring his cheeks is more damning. I walked into that, didn't I? I mutter, turning back to my window. Behind me, he chuffs out a laugh. Absolutely. Then Cameron slams a hand to her window, hissing. Green smoke. Weapon sector. Shit. Killorn jumps to her side, drawing his gun. He eyes her, worried. Why shit? Weapon sector has most security, she says quickly. With even motions, she peels off her jacket, revealing her own gun and a wicked knife I hope she never has to use. For obvious reasons. I exhale slowly. Inside me, the lightning snaps and crackles. More likely to blow up, too. With a roll of his shoulders, Killorn dons a scowl. He touches Cameron lightly on the arm, pulling her back from the window. Let's make sure that doesn't happen, he mutters, kicking out the glass. Shards explode out and in, shattering with the force of the blow. Still grimacing, he wipes one jacketed sleeve around the frame, knocking loose any jagged edges. He then steps back to let me lean out and brace myself on the ledge. A smoky wind blows against my face, smelling of fumes and distant fire. Without hesitation, I slip one leg out the window, then the other. Killorn grabs the back of my shirt, keeping a firm grip. I look skyward, focusing on the blue dawn as it melts to pink. Even though the sky is choked with corrupted clouds, they make for lovely colors. My heartbeat thrums, rising to a steady rhythm. The lightning in me pulses with it, feeding off the electricity below. I clench a fist, trying to remember what Ella taught me. Storm lightning is the strongest and most destructive kind we can make. It gathers, it grows, it breaks. Overhead, the vibrantly colored clouds begin to darken and swirl, condensing with my power. Before my eyes, identical shadows bloom over two other parts of the city, Ella and Rafe. The three of us make a triangle, with the electricity hub at our center, the city spread out before us like a killing ground. And Titan is somewhere down there, more dangerous than any of us, ready to loose his pulse lightning on anyone who might get too close. Blue lightning flashes first, illuminating the curls of a rising thunderhead to my left. The roar of close thunder cracks over us, and I feel Killorn flinch, the motion tugging my shirt. I stand firm, keeping my grip on the window frame. Purple and green join the fray as our storms collide, raining bolts down on our target. The hub, a domed building near the center of the city, is easily distinguished by the tangle of wires reaching in every direction, connecting power stations all over the city and feeding back electricity into the factories, the lifeblood of any slum town. Even from this distance, I can feel the low hum of it. Make it rain, Killorn snarls. I bite back a sigh. That's not how it works, I hiss back, throwing a bolt across the sky. The other electrocons do as well, their blue and green racing toward my purple. Our strikes hit directly above the hub, birthing a blinding flash. On cue, the hum disappears as our allies inside take the hub system offline. They shut it down more quickly than even we could, and with far fewer casualties. All over the city, smokestacks stop belching out their poison, assembly lines grind to a halt. Even transports on the streets, isolated with their own energy sources, slow or pull over, surprised by the sudden shutdown. The storm continues, a three-headed monster, sending cracks of lightning across the sky in all directions. I keep my bolts away from the ground for now. I can't aim them well at this distance, and don't want to risk innocent lives. Not to mention the Scarlet Guard explosives, which are now set all over the city. One spark from me could set off a chain of bursting death. All stop, Cameron murmurs next to me. She looks out on her city with marvel in her eyes. No power means no work. Shifts turned out all over. Workers bang for their wages, officers distracted, overseers overrun. Blind to the cutthroats, criminals, and soldiers now in their midst. Blind to the bombs beneath their feet. How long until the first detonation cuts Killorn off, rumbling a little too close for comfort? An explosion rises to our left, two streets away, at one of the city gates. Rock and smoke streak through the air in a dusty, dragging arc. The next bomb obliterates another gate, followed by the other two. Then, the interior charges blow. Beneath security posts, guard towers, silver barracks, the overseer's quarters, any and all silver targets. I wince with each strike, trying not to think of how much blood we spilled today, on both sides, who will be caught in the crossfire. We watch in silence, cowed by the sight. More smoke, more dust, and now ash. Cameron's chest rises and falls as her breath turns to panting. Her wide, dark eyes dart back and forth, always returning to the factories marking the weapons sector. Nothing explodes there. The Scarlet Guard isn't stupid enough to put bombs beneath a munitions depot, I tell her, hoping to comfort her a little. Then, it explodes. The resulting force knocks us all backward, sending us sprawling over broken glass in the dusty attic. Cameron scrambles up first, bleeding from a cut on the forehead. "Then that wasn't the guard," she yelps, pulling me to my feet. My ears ring, dulling all sound. I shake my head from side to side, trying to get my bearings. Cameron takes my wrists, and I instantly jump, flinching out of her grasp. "No," I snarl, unable to stand the feeling. She doesn't react and instead focuses on getting Killorn up, putting one of her arms over her shoulder to hoist him. His lip is busted, and one of his hands has a gash from the glass, but the rest of him seems whole. "I think we might want to get our feet on the ground," he says, focusing on the cracked ceiling above us. "Agreed." My voice sounds oddly strangled as we bolt for the door. The stairs are little more than a tight spiral, reaching down and down and down. A chore to climb and even worse to descend, each step a jolt through my knees. I pull my lightning to my fingertips, letting the purple sparks gather and spit, ready to run through anyone in our way. Killorn overtakes me easily, moving down the stairs two at a time. I hate it when he does that, and he knows it. The boy even has the spine to smirk back at me, winking. In that moment, Cameron screams, seeing the Silver Guard before we do. He waves an arm, sending Killorn sideways over the railing with the force of telekinetic ability. My vision slows as Killorn topples, body sprawled in the air, and I feel like someone is digging a knife into my gut. The ringing in my ears threatens to split my head, rising to a shriek. All down the stairwell, light bulbs pop and hiss with my fear, spreading darkness. The guard drops before he can turn his wrath on us. He clutches at his throat, eyes rolling as he lands hard on his knee. Cameron curls her hand, fingers claw-like, as she smothers him with her ability, slowing his heart, darkening his vision, killing him. The crack and thud of Killorn hitting the railing below makes me sick. We sprint as fast as we can, directly into two other Silver Guards working their way up to us. A shiver freezes the steps beneath our feet, and my boots slide, almost taking me down. I slice him apart with a rocketing bolt, while his partner, a stone skin, topples under Cameron's wrath. We cut them apart, knives through paper. I reach Killorn first. He rolls to a stop two floors down, landing sprawled across several rows of steps. The first thing I see is his chest, rising and falling. Shallow, but moving, breathing. He's choking on blood, red and crimson, scarlet, ruby. The color so bright I want to shut my eyes. He coughs, violently, flecking both Cameron and me. The hot droplets pepper my face. "Get him up. We have to get him up," I mumble, scrambling over him. Cameron follows, deathly quiet. I want to scream. He can't speak but tries to rise on his own. I almost slap him. "Let us," I bark, throwing his arm around me. "Cam, the other side." She's already there, heaving. He's an anchor, a dead weight. Killorn jolts and hacks, painting the steps with his own blood. I don't bother trying to assess the damage. I just know I have to get him out, get him down, get him to any one of the healers all over the city. I need Davidson. I need someone. My chest tightens, but I refuse to feel the agony or the strain of him. My legs burn with every new step. Down, 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 down. "Mare," Cameron sobs. "Stop it." He's still warm, still breathing, still retching blood all over himself. That's enough for me. Probably broken ribs, cracked bone, sharp and digging into his organs. Stomach, lungs, liver. "Stay away from the heart," I beg. "We don't have time to survive a pierced heart." I taste salt and realize I'm crying, washing my face of his blood with my tears. The floors pass in a blur, sliding by. Killorn sucks down a wet, rattling breath. His face and hands are paler by the second. All we can do is run. More guards charge up the stairs, baying like hounds on a scent. I barely see them, barely feel their nerves as they shred beneath my lightning. Some fall quickly, bleeding from the eyes and mouth and ears as Cameron hammers her ability through their bodies. But there are so many, too many, flooding up to meet us. This way! Cameron barks, her voice still tear-filled as she slams her body through a door on the next landing. I follow without thought, crossing through a cramped and meager apartment. Where Cameron is taking us, I can't say. All I can do is keep hold of Killorn and my lightning, the only two things in my world. Hold on, I hear myself whisper to Killorn, too low for anyone to hear. Cameron leads us to the closest window, another square of grimy glass, but this one opens onto an adjoining rooftop. She knocks out the window, using one long leg to kick the pane free. My lightning holds our backs from pursuing Silvers, allowing us enough time to clamber out and onto the roof. The officers follow, squeezing their larger and broader bodies through the broken window and onto the ashy roof behind us, beneath the torturous, thundering sky. Once there's enough distance between us and the guards, I gently lower Killorn, laying him down against the concrete. His lashes flutter, eyes glassy, as Cameron stands over him, her stance wide and defensive. I put my back to her, facing down the Silvers struggling onto the roof. I count six already on the roof, with more squeezing through. What their abilities might be, if they belong to any family I recognize, I don't know, and I don't care. As soon as the last Silver's feet hit the concrete, I unleash. The storm opens above me, purple and violent, blinding with my fury. I'm screaming, but the force absorbs all sound, all thought. The lightning swallows the bodies, killing them so quickly I don't even feel them. Not their nerves, not their skeletons, nothing. When the lightning clears, it's the smell that brings me back. Killorn's blood, ash, burned hair, and cooked flesh. Behind me, Cameron makes a gulping sound, like she's trying not to vomit. I have to look away from the charred remains. Only their buttons and guns remain intact, smoking with heat. I barely heave a breath before a deafening crack splits the singed air, and the roof shudders beneath our feet. Cameron drops, covering Killorn with her body as the entire building lurches, starts to lean, slowly at first, then faster and faster. I fall to my knees, reaching for Cameron and Killorn as the structure buckles. My storm was too strong, the apartment building too poorly made. The walls are crumbling on one side, making us tip. All I can do is hang on as the roof snaps and falls, sliding forward at a steady incline. I slide with it, scrabbling, fingers grasping for anything to hold on to. My fist closes on the collar of Killorn's jacket, sticky with hot, wet blood. His breath rattles, weaker than ever, as we move with the collapsing roof. The ground rises up to meet us, a fist of concrete. Silver officers wait below, ready to kill us if the collapse doesn't. I clench my teeth, bracing for impact. I've never felt so helpless and afraid. At first, I can only blink at the sudden, translucent blue glow in front of me. It hovers, holding up the edge of the tipping roof, stopping the falling slab, but not us. We slide along the angle dragged through the ash until we smack against the shield. Bullets sound below, and out of instinct I squeeze my eyes shut, curling up. They ping harmlessly off the shield, sending ripples of force dancing beneath us. Davidson. One eye opens to see a massacre below us, a smoky haze of blue and green and white lightning as it branches among the Silvers. Titan's white darts fell, four of them, in an instant, while Ella and Rafe batter the rest with their whipping electricity. The shield moves as they fight, letting the roof down gently. We hit the ground with a low thud, sending up a curtain of gray dust. Killorn is tall, lean, but heavy. My adrenaline makes him almost weightless. I barely notice the strain as I lift him again, throwing one of his arms over my shoulder. Still breathing, still breathing. Cameron takes his other side, and we charge through the ash, without thought for the lightning or the silver still fighting. Healers, I roar, screaming as loudly as I can to be heard over the din. We need healers! Cameron echoes my cries, her voice carrying. She's stronger and taller than I am, taking the brunt of Killorn's weight. He doesn't slow her down. The Premier meets us head-on, his personal guard fanned out around him. There's a smear of blood on his cheek. Red blood. I don't have time to wonder who it belongs to. We need... I gasp out, but Killorn shudders, doubling over on himself. He almost tumbles out of our grasp and forces us to stop. Another wave of blood spatters the ground, painting my boots. I almost faint with relief when the healer charges forward from Davidson's soldiers. The red-haired new blood has a familiar face, but I don't have enough energy to remember his name. Lay him down, the man barks, and we gratefully obey. The only thing I can do is hold Killorn's hand, his skin cold against the flame of my own. He's still alive. We made it in time. We were enough. Cameron kneels over him, silent and staring, hands knitted in her lap, afraid to touch him. Internal bleeding, the healer mutters, ripping open Killorn's shirt. His abdomen is almost black with bruises. As the healer dances his fingers, pressing and prodding, they begin to recede. Killorn grimaces, teeth gritted against the strange sensation.
It's like someone took a hammer to your ribs.
Feels like it, he grinds out. His voice is strained but alive. I squeeze my eyes shut, and I wish I had gods to thank for his life. His grip tightens on my hand, squeezing my fingers, forcing me to look at him. Bottle green eyes meet mine, eyes that have followed me my entire life. Eyes almost shut forever. It's okay, Mare. I'm fine. He whispers. I'm not going anywhere. We stay by him, silent guardians, as the healer works. I flinch in time with the distant rumble of explosions and artillery, some of it far away, beyond Newtown, muffled by the miles. The assault of Harbor Bay has begun, a three-pronged attack to take the city. Will they win the day? Will we? The Electricons close in on us, picking their way back through the dozen silver corpses littering the road. Titan idles, turning over a few with his foot, while Rafe looks on. Ella gives me the smallest wave as she approaches. Her scarf is gone, and ash colors her blue hair in streaks of gray, aging her. One hand twists idly at her side, and the thunderheads above, silent for now, spin with the motion. She winks at me, trying to put on a brave face. Rafe and Titan are more blatant in their grimness. Both keep their hands free, ready to push back any assault. But no one seems to be coming. Either the fighting is concentrated elsewhere, or it's already over. Thank you, I murmur, my voice cracking. Titan's reply is swift. We protect our own. Still more to go, but out of the woods. I look back to see the healer ease Killorn into a sitting position. Cameron helps gingerly, putting a hand to the bare skin on his back. Suddenly, I feel like I'm intruding on something I shouldn't. With the back of my hand, I quickly swipe away the blood, sweat, and tears, dirtying my face. I'm going to find out what's going on, I mumble, getting to my feet before anyone can protest. My boots crunch through the debris as I beeline for the Electricons. Rafe offers a weak grin. He rips the covering off his head and runs a hand over his closely cropped green hair. Looks like he'll be okay, he says, jutting his chin back at Killorn. I exhale slowly. Looks like it. What about you all? Ella puts an arm around me, lithe as a sapphire cat. Had less trouble than you, that's for sure. I think we brought a bit more firepower than anyone might expect for a place like this. The Nortons here were outnumbered and unprepared. Titan spits at the street. Silver Kings don't expect anyone to care, let alone fight, for a red slum. I blink at the implication, surprised. So we won. They're certainly acting like we did, Titan replies. He gestures with a hand, pointing to the Montfort and guard soldiers now holding the street. They could be red techies, if not for the machine guns hanging off them. A few seem to be laughing, exchanging pleasantries with the Premier as he walks among them. Wonder how they're doing in Harbor Bay, Ella says, kicking up a puff of dust. I lower my eyes. My heart still thunders in my chest, pumping adrenaline through my veins. It makes it hard to think about anything beyond the street, let alone the people I love, fighting and perhaps dying a few miles away. For a second I try to forget, collect myself, breathe deep and easy. It doesn't work. Premier, I bark, crossing to him with force. He looks back, smiling, and even waves a hand to motion me over, like I need an invitation. "Barrow," he says. "Congratulations on a job well done." It's hard to feel celebratory with Killorn lying a few feet away, even with a healer patching him up. That was far too close. "What about the city? Any word from Farley?" His smile freezes in place. "Some." Something tightens in my chest. "What's that supposed to mean?" I demand. "Is she alive?" Davidson indicates one of his soldiers, her pack a mess of wires and radio equipment. "As of a few minutes ago, yes. I spoke to the general myself." "And Tiberius?" I bite back the urge to ask about him, at least by name. "Did everything go to plan?" I force out, my mind flying over the many facets of the Harbor Bay invasion. The Premier's face tightens. "Did you expect it to?" he murmurs. I almost snarl in frustration. Another round of artillery thunders miles away. As the adrenaline in me ebbs, a cold takes over, threatening to numb my body. I look back for a moment, watching Cameron as she kneels with Killorn. They aren't talking. Both of them are wide-eyed, nearly pinned down by exhaustion and the aftertaste of fear. Then I glance to the electrocons. All three of them stare back, resolute, ready to follow, ready to protect their own. My decision only takes a split second. Get me a transport.
19. Evangeline. I've never liked Harbor Bay. It stinks of fish and salt water, even in the silver districts. Soon it will smell only of blood. The 2 weeks of rest in the rift flew by, each minute passing faster than the last. Only last night I was home, nestled against Elaine, whispering my goodbyes. I wasn't afraid then. I believed Father wouldn't let his heirs anywhere close to true danger. Ptolemus and I would be safe, held in reserve to watch the siege and wade in when the fighting ebbed. I was wrong. His hunger is deeper than I ever imagined. He put us on the front lines without a thought. Now our boats race over the ocean waves, skimming along the stormy blue, cresting with each flash of white foam. I narrow my eyes against the spray, even behind my goggles. The wind tears at my hair with the damp chill of seawater. It would knock me over if my boots weren't fused to the steel deck below my feet. My ability courses, a low pulse in time with my boat skipping over the water. We ride with the fog, hidden for now. Montfort's storm soldiers are talented and powerful. I note ours at the corner of my eye, tall and willowy in her green uniform tightened by ballistic armor. She is helmeted too, only her hands bare, fingers splayed at her sides to drag the fog. No more coveralls or training outfits for anyone. This is real. House Samos leads the assault from the water, pushing on our metal crafts at high speed. Father is willing to risk our house for victory. Three cousins form the diamond wedge of our frontal assault, their crafts slicing ahead of us. Behind me in my boat, Ptolemus stands firm, his body weighed down with mirrored armor and weaponry. Gun belts crisscross my hips, snug against my muscles. I have a pistol, though I prefer to throw the bullets myself if need be. My cousins of House Samos vary, carrying rifles as well as shard explosives. I picture the seawalls of Port Patriot, high against the waves. Our first obstacle. My focus sharpens as we approach, narrowing to this place and our objective. Win the city. Survive. Go home. They will see us coming, or at least they'll see the fog rolling off the water. It's early morning, though, when the air is still heavy and gray. A natural fog wouldn't seem out of place. It could give us cover longer than anything else. And when Cal strikes from the land,
and House Loras from the air. The city guards and the Patriot garrison won't know where to turn, which front to fight. Everything is well coordinated, from the grander assault to each individual boat. Our ranks are well organized. 2 magnetrons, 1 storm, 1 gravitron, at least to each craft, supplemented by trained Red soldiers or other new bloods of Montfort, as well as a few healers sprinkled through each battalion. Everyone has their job, and if we're all going to survive, we're going to do them well. Fort Patriot looms, a hazy shadow darkening as our fog pushes on. The seawall rises from a breaking rush of white waves. No land below, no foothold, no matter. For all my anger and rage, I wish my father were here. There is no safer place than his side. My concentration breaks for a moment as my focus shifts to my brother. I can sense him behind me and easily trace the shape of his armor. We each carry a small but solid disc of copper tucked into our belts. An odd metal for an attack. Easy to distinguish and feel. Easy to track. I hold on to the sensation of his and mine, memorizing it. If things go wrong, I want to be able to find Tali as quickly as I can. The fog outstrips us, easing against the fast-approaching seawall. Whatever clock ticks inside me grows louder, more insistent. It's time. Shivering, I turn with a jolt and wrap my arms around Tali's shoulders. The hug is quick, sharp, and not gentle. The clang of metal on metal as our armor meets is swallowed by the roaring waves and the rising thunder of my heartbeat. "Stay alive," he whispers. I can only nod as I turn back around. No movement on the seawall, either above or below. Just the waves. Maybe the fog has worked. "Ready?" I hiss over the din, looking to the barrel-chested Montfort Gravitron. He dips his chin in assertion before crouching against the boat, putting his hand to each side. His palms go flat, ready to lift. In the other boats, the other Gravitons do the same. The soldiers behind me kneel. The storm, our 2 oblivions of Laralan and Ptolemus, brace for the leap. No Reds in my boat. I want to survive this, and do it without relying on the weakness of Red blood, no matter how trained they might be. I bend down with the rest, my muscles tensing, dreading the chance of impact, if the Gravitron isn't up to snuff. At this speed, I might not be able to stop the boat from slamming into the seawall. Waves break along the base of the wall, steel gray beneath the fog. They lap high, higher than the crusted saltwater line worn against the wall, higher than any high tide. My heart drops in my chest. "Nymph strike!" I manage to scream as another towering wave crashes backward. So begins the battle of Harbor Bay. The sudden furious wall of water tosses the lead boats like toys, spilling soldiers of the Rift and Montfort across the churning ocean break. Only the Gravitons escape, bouncing up and out of the water's grasp. I spot the Samos cousins utilizing control of their armor to stay afloat or skim the waves, but they're weighed down and not strong enough to pull themselves out of harm's way. I don't know about the rest. We have nymphs of our own, Montfort-born silvers, but far fewer and far weaker than whoever must be on the Patriot walls. Whatever we do to calm the boiling waves isn't enough. Another wave rises, half as high as the wall, blocking out the graying light, casting a shadow across our line of craft. It will flatten us, drown us, slam us against the seabed. "Push through," I command, clenching my fists on the prow of our boat, pouring myself and my ability into the hull. I hope the Gravitron can hear me. I know Ptolemus does. The craft ripples under our touch, narrowing,
fluting, the prow sharpening to a knife's edge, gaining speed. I flatten myself as much as I can. We angle at the wave, a bullet with passengers. The water is a cold slap, and all I can do is keep my mouth shut as it blasts over us. We rocket through the wave, bursting into midair on the other side, sailing up and over toward the seawall.
Brace! Ptolemus roars as we hurtle for the stone at high speed.
I grit my teeth, fingers digging into the metal hull, pulling, pushing, hoping we don't fall, hoping we don't crash. The gravitron gives us the extra bounce we need, keeping us airborne. We hit hard, hull against the seawall, sliding up against gravity. Other crafts slam in alongside us, racing up in tangled formation. Most of our assault made it. Metal screams along stone, outpacing the waves below, even as they reach higher and higher, casting spray like rain. I spit seawater and blink, glad for my goggles as we push up and over. Nymphs line the ramparts, marked by blue stripes on clouded gray or black uniforms. Trained silver soldiers and guards, the garrison of Fort Patriot, bolstered by Lakelander uniforms. We spill from our boats with little grace, sliding onto the walkway crowning the wall. I use my own armor to stop me from toppling over the edge, while Ptolemus shreds the boat with abandon, sending razor edges spiraling in all directions. The gravitrons fling enemy soldiers into the sea. Fog crawls over the walls and into the fort, obscuring our soldiers. Somewhere, a few of our storms break off. Their job is to call up thunder, cultivate lightning, shock and awe the garrison, send them running, make them think Barrow is here. Blooms of fire and smoke dot the walls. Oblivions weave, leaving burning corpses in their wake. One shrieks as he's caught off guard and hurled over the wall into the angry waters. Fort Patriot crawls with enemy strong arms, blood of House Rombos, or their Greco and Caros cousins. One of them, a woman muscled like a mountain, tears a Montfort storm apart before my eyes, ripping flesh and bone like paper. I keep my head. I've seen worse. I think. Gunfire peppers the air. Bullets and abilities are a deadly combination. I raise an arm, fist clenched, shielding myself from the assault. Bullets bounce off my ability, flattened or sheared. I catch a few and send them hurtling back into the fog, hunting after the flashes of turret fire. We have to open the gates, win the fort. Our objective, our job, is straightforward but not simple. Fort Patriot bisects the famed harbor of the city, dividing the waters into the civilian Aquarian port and the war port. Right now, I only care about one. The low thunder of heavy guns, the kind found on battleships, beats like a drum. I try to trace the missiles, reaching across the distance to decipher their trajectory. It's too far, but I can guess. I'm silver. I know how we think. Form a shield! I shout to the Samos magnetrons, pulling up the metal from our boats and weapons. Ptolemus follows my lead, knitting together a steel wall as quickly as he can. The whistle of artillery grows closer, and I look up, squinting through the haze. With a snap, I rip the goggles off my face to see an arc of smoke looping overhead. The first missile explodes 50 yards ahead, pulverizing a section of the seawall, turning friend and foe to gray or pink mist in equal measure. Only the oblivions survive, some naked, their armor and uniforms charred right off their bodies. We cower behind our steel, weathering the blast as it pulses forward. The smoke stings, acrid and poisoned with bone dust. We won't survive a direct hit like that, not with what we have here. We can deflect the missiles as best we can, but it's only a matter of time before one of them catches us.
Get off the wall, I force out, tasting blood. Into the fort. All to plan. Get the battleships to open up, pummel their own walls. Keep the heavy fire on the fort, not the city or the air fleet. That's what Cal said they would do, and somehow the idiots are doing it. Another round hits, cracking stone, as we grapple down the seawall, our ranks bleeding into Patriot. I look back, counting as quickly as I can. Maybe 60 of us made it in, down from our original strike group of 75 souls. 75 deadly silvers and battle-hardened reds, their guns lethal and precise. But their fire is reserved for silvers. I notice they don't bother with the soldiers in rusty red uniforms, the many conscripted assigned to the Patriot garrison. Some of those reds follow their officers, running out to fight our ranks as we push on. Fewer than expected, though. As General Farley assured us, the word went out through her channels. The reds of the city have been warned. When the assault comes, turn, run, or fight with us if you can. Many do, joining our train of death. Thunderheads pulse above, turning the sky black. Their lightning is unpredictable, less powerful than Mare's, but a symbol all the same. Enemy soldiers look up as we approach, the silvers eyeing what can only be the work of the Lightning Girl. She isn't here, you idiots, I sneer in my head. Cowards, afraid of a bit of flashing light. The interior fort is an experiment in chaos. By now, Cal will have begun his own assault, marching his battalion up and out of the tunnel system Harbor Bay is built on. It is an old city, well-preserved through the ages, with deep and twisting roots. The Scarlet Guard knows them all. We make it to the central byway of the fort, moving quickly and without pattern, leading the battleship fire, letting it follow and destroy, keeping the worst weaponry from the city itself. Cal is so preoccupied with protecting innocents, probably just to show Mare he can. Hanging me out to dry in the process. I cut through another wave of combatants, using a combination of bullets and blades to level the men and women in front of me. Their faces are shadows to me, inhuman, unworthy of memory. It's the only way to do this properly. The whine and thrum of artillery become a familiar rhythm. I duck for cover as easily as I fight, moving in time with the noise. Smoke and ash swirl with the fog, leaving everyone behind. The Patriot garrison is hopelessly adrift. They don't have a plan for this kind of attack. We certainly do. My first burst of fear comes when I realize Ptolemus is no longer at my side, hemmed in by our protective circle of cousins. I glance at each of them, searching familiar faces of pale skin and silver hair. He isn't here. Tali! I hear myself scream as another missile blasts, closer this time. I crouch and brace, letting the concussive wave pass over me. Rebel breaks against my armor, coating my left side with dust. Blinking, I stand before the rest, whirling around, on the hunt. Terror claws up my spine, leaving icy open wounds. Ptolemus! Whatever focus I had before slips through my grasp and everything splinters. The world spins. Where is my brother? Where is he? Did we leave him behind? Did he push on? Is he hurt? Is he dying? Is he dead? The pop of gunfire snaps too close, a grim reminder. I whirl against our tide of soldiers. One of them knocks into me, her shoulder slamming mine, and I stumble. Gasping, I throw out my senses, reaching with my ability, trying to locate that disc of copper, that tiny nub of pale orange metal, a different weight, a different feel. I come back empty. Nothing. I told him we would be safe, even on the front lines of battle. Father would not waste us. Father would not let us go anywhere that might jeopardize his legacy. I suck down a poisoned breath, still scanning the silhouettes around me as the ash falls like summer snow. It coats our uniforms, no matter the color. we all start to look the same. Even if Father doesn't love us the way he should, he still values us. He wouldn't trade our lives like this, wouldn't let us die for his crown. But here we are. Tears prick my eyes. From the ash, I tell myself, the sting of smoke. Suddenly, the copper rings on the edge of my perception, so small I almost miss it. My neck snaps with force as I turn, hunting for my brother. Without thought, I shove a few soldiers out of my way, vaulting through the swarm of battle. I duck under the arm of an approaching strong arm, tossing a bullet his way as I go. I feel it punch through his neck, a clean through and through. He drops behind me, clawing at his open jugular. Every step brings new shapes into focus. The streets of Fort Patriot, meticulously organized in a grid, are easy to navigate. I hang my closest right, a hound sniffing at a bone. Above me, walkways connect the various buildings. Soldiers in rusty uniforms charge back and forth, guns at the ready. I raise my forearm, shielding myself from the accompanying volley of gunfire. Red soldiers all, attacking from a safe distance. I let the bullets drop, flattened and useless. No use wasting my energy trying to kill them. Ptolemus comes into view around the corner, sprinting, blissfully whole. I almost drop in relief. Smoke spirals behind him, evidence of more artillery fire. Missiles whistle overhead again, before exploding with resounding rumbles.
"What were you doing, you idiot?" I shout, skidding to a halt.
"Don't stop. Run," he screams, catching me under the arm. I'm almost yanked off my feet by the force. I know better than to argue when my brother is so incredibly terrified. All I can do is get my feet under myself, reorient, and sprint as fast as I can, keeping pace at his side. "The seawall,"
he forces out between pants of exertion. It isn't difficult to connect the dots. I make the terrible mistake of looking back over my shoulder. Through the smoke, the fog, the thunder breaking overhead. To the cracks in the wall as they spread, pieces of stone as they crumble. The wall of water forcing itself up and over and in. Standing over it, poised on a balcony, is the person controlling it all, her arms wide, her armor so deeply blue it could be black. Iris Signet watches us run. A swoop of panic nearly roots me to the spot, but Tali drags me on, his hand wrapped around my bicep in a painfully tight grip. We skid out, back into the main street, chasing after our battalion only to find the lower levels of the fort deserted. Our soldiers are forward, and the rest, the enemies, they are up. Climbing into the buildings, standing on rooftops, clinging to the high ground with their weapons ready. No use trying to get to high ground.